Good Tuesday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, right here on Ray TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125, and more. Coming to you once again from beautiful downtown Farmville, Virginia. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad that you have joined us today. We have a busy show for you. Andrew Langer coming up a little bit later on in the hour with the Institute for Liberty. We'll talk about the net neutrality fight, which has been restarted in Washington, D.C., also some of the other big stories of the day. Later in the hour, Scott Bach joins us from the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, also a member of the NRA's Board of Directors, on the communities, particularly in North Jersey, that are protesting the National Right to Carry Reciprocity bill that is currently before Congress. Also next hour, Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom joining us for this week's Liberty Update. Also, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins at Breitbart News on the 21 gun controls currently being pushed by Democrats in the Senate and their surrogates outside of Congress. Also in hour three, we have today's hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. Good guy as well. Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, will be with us. And Derek Hunter is going to join us as well, host of the Derek Hunter Show on WBAL in Baltimore, Maryland. We'll talk about a story at the Baltimore Sun. And, I mean, well, actually, the story is from the Wall Street Journal. But it is all about what is going on in Baltimore, Maryland, where, again, they are on pace now or near a pace for a record-setting number of homicides. More than 300 people have been murdered in Baltimore, Maryland this year, the highest per capita homicide rate among the nation's big cities. You know, we talk a lot about Chicago, and Chicago has more homicides in terms of the raw numbers than Baltimore does, but Chicago also has a far greater population than Baltimore. And in Baltimore, where, again, you know, anti-gun advocates passed sweeping gun control legislation. Governor Martin O'Malley signed it into law 4 years ago. Since the Maryland Firearm Safety Act was signed into law in 2013, Baltimore, Maryland has seen three of the highest homicide rates in the city's history. Again, what we're told is that, well, it's another state's fault, right? It's not that gun control doesn't work. It's not that the criminals in Baltimore aren't paying attention to these laws. It's not like these laws aren't being enforced. No. It's because Virginia doesn't have the same kind of gun control laws that Maryland has, even though Virginia's violent crime rate is far lower than Maryland. It's Pennsylvania's fault because they don't have the same kind of gun control laws that Maryland does. West Virginia doesn't have the same kind of gun control laws that Maryland does. So even though those states might have less violent crime, the argument goes that the criminals in Baltimore are somehow going to these other states, I guess illegally acquiring firearms and returning home to Baltimore to inflict murder and mayhem on the residents there. Again, we'll talk about this with Derek Hunter coming up in hour three. Also, just up the road from Baltimore, Maryland, Wilmington, Delaware. Wilmington last week had before the city council a local ordinance that would have established a gun offender registry, kind of like a sex offender registry. So if you had been convicted of a firearm-related crime, even a possessory offense, you would have been required to report to the Wilmington Police Department. You've had to add your name to a registry kept by the Wilmington Police Department. If you moved, you would have had to alert the Wilmington Police Department to the fact that you were moving. If you failed to do this, then you would be looking at up to 12 months in jail and or a $1,000 fine. It was Friday that the City Council of Wilmington voted on this measure, and they rejected it. 6-5. It was a close vote. Councilman Namandi Chukwuacha said, this is nothing but double jeopardy. We're just placing them in another form of probation or being under city supervision. I think it's uncalled for. Bob Williams, who is the sponsor of the legislation, former Wilmington police officer, said that this would help curb gun violence, that cities like Baltimore and Chicago already have their gun offender registry set up. Again, I don't know that that's necessarily a huge selling point, given the violent crime in those cities. ACLU in Delaware Had argued to the Wilmington City Council last month, according to Chris Edger at Guns.com, that gun offender registries don't reduce crime, lead to unnecessary incarceration, and can give police unconstitutional authority. Michael Bloomberg, back when he was mayor of New York, signed in the first gun offender registry into law in 2006. We've seen some cities around the country do the same over the past decade or so. But again, you're starting to see some pushback to some of these proposals. And it so far, it hasn't necessarily spilled over into the gun control movement itself. There's still this sort of weird separation between what we saw in Baltimore earlier this year, a proposal by the city council that would have mandated a year behind bars for anybody caught in the legal possession of a firearm. That ultimately was watered down. This was unveiled to great fanfare in Baltimore. Again, the city council members who proposed that in Baltimore thought, all right, the public's going to love this. I mean, here we are in the midst of record high homicides. We got to do something. So this is what we're going to do. You get caught with illegal possession of a firearm. You spend a mandatory minimum 1 year in jail. And the first hearing that they had for this bill, you had protests that shut down the city council chambers. And it wasn't, you know, angry legal gun owners. Wasn't a lot of NRA members there. Community activists said, wait. You know, I know somebody who's maybe carrying a firearm illegally, but they're not a violent criminal. They're carrying because we live in a dangerous city and they want to be able to protect themselves. I don't think they should go to jail for that. And ultimately, the city council watered this bill down. It went from a mandatory one-year jail sentence to a mandatory get-out-of-jail-free upon first offense sentence. No possibility of jail time for a first offense. Now, again, these were city council members who thought, okay, well, you know what? Let's just propose a gun control law. They got faced with a lot of pushback from people who said, what is this going to do to reduce violent crime? As opposed to, what is this going to do to put my son, my brother, my father in jail for a year simply for carrying a firearm? Now, again, the city council backed off of that proposal. They didn't do what I think was the logical next step, which would be to say, okay, listen, clearly there are a lot of residents in Baltimore who believe that people are carrying a firearm for self-defense. They don't have any ill intent, but they want to be able to protect themselves. Now, they can't do that legally unless they get a concealed carry license. And they're probably not going to be able to get one of those in Maryland because Maryland is a may-issue state. You have to show a specific reason or need to carry a firearm for self-defense. And living in a bad neighborhood in Baltimore isn't seen as a good enough reason. So I would have hoped that the city council in Baltimore, upon hearing what these residents had to say, would have come to the conclusion of, okay, if we have people who are carrying right now against, and they're breaking the law by doing so, but we have a lot of people who say, well, they shouldn't go to jail for doing this, maybe what we should do is give these folks, or otherwise legal law-abiding folks, the opportunity and the availability to actually carry lawfully and legally, like they do in, you know, most other states around the country. Maybe that way we wouldn't, you know, have to put people behind bars because they wanted to protect their life, because they would have the option and the means to do this without breaking the law. They haven't done that yet in Baltimore, Maryland. They did not take that step. I think that was a bridge too far. So you're at this weird place where in a lot of cities that are dealing with violent crime, The impetus and that first thought for a lot of these politicians is, well, okay, well, let's go the gun control route. And they're meeting resistance. Again, in a lot of cases, it's not the gun owners. It's not the Second Amendment advocates who are putting up this resistance, because in a lot of these cities, there's not much of a legal gun culture anymore. They've done a really good job of eradicating a legal and lawful gun culture. So instead, the primary pushback is coming from folks who say, listen, the criminal justice system is messed up. It's systemically flawed. And you put a bunch of gun control laws on the books, and guess what's going to happen? They're going to be used disproportionately against young minorities, just like the current laws that are on the books are being used disproportionately against young minorities. So there is this split. There's a butting of heads here between two philosophies under one ideology. You know, the ideology is the quote unquote progressive ideology, but the two philosophies are guns are bad. We got to get rid of guns, and the criminal justice system is bad, and we have to reform the criminal justice system. And those two arguments are butting heads right now in Baltimore, in Chicago, and even in Wilmington, Delaware. I'll give you another place where this might be bumping heads here. Kansas City Star had a commentary piece. This was yesterday. I guess this was posted last night. I'm a gun owner. The extremists don't speak for most of us. This was Cindy Spate writing in the Kansas City Star. She is a volunteer with the Missouri chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. And she tries to make the case that, gosh, you know, Missouri has passed these pro-gun pieces of legislation, and it's been disastrous. But look at what's happened in states that have passed, you know, gun control legislation. Now, she uses just two examples, just one compare and contrast. She contrasts Missouri with Connecticut. She says the record is clear that opening new loopholes has been tragic for Missouri. Since 2008, she says, when Missouri repealed its law requiring background checks on all handgun sales, the state has seen a 25% increase in the firearm homicide rate. She says a 16% increase in the firearm suicide death rate, as well as an increase in handgun assaults against law enforcement officers. By contrast, she says, after Connecticut enacted a law requiring background checks on all gun sales, similar, she says, to the one that Missouri repealed, it experienced a 40% reduction in firearm homicide and a 15% reduction in firearm suicide. So I got curious. I started looking at the numbers in Missouri and in Connecticut because I was kind of curious. So Missouri, she says, the law was changed in 2008. You've got almost a decade worth of crime data to look at. Now, in Missouri, you go back to 2008, the homicide rate was 7.7 in the state of Missouri. The year after that law that repealed the quote-unquote universal background checks went into effect, the homicide rate actually dropped from 7.7 to 6.5%. 2010, it went up to 7 per 100,000 people. Then it dropped again to 6.1. Up to 6.5, down to 6.1, up to 6.7. And then in 2015, the homicide rate in Missouri shot up from 6.7 to 8.3 per 100,000 people. 2016, it went up again, 8.8 homicides per 100,000 people. But that increase in the homicide rate in Missouri didn't happen right after the law dealing with quote-unquote universal background checks was repealed. As a matter of fact, homicide rate was actually lower than what it was in 2008, right up until 2015. And like the country as a whole, the state of Missouri saw an increase in violent crime beginning in 2015, continuing into 2016. What about Connecticut? So you kind of, this is where it gets really weird. So this volunteer with Moms Demand Action had said, you know, Connecticut, they changed their law, and amazing things happened. This is based on a report from the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. Yes, the Bloomberg School of Public Health put out a press release on a paper by Stuart Rudolph, Daniel Webster, and one other anti-gun researcher. They said a 1995 Connecticut law that required a purchase or a permit or license in order to purchase a handgun associated with a 40% reduction in the state's firearm-related homicide rate. Dr. John Lott from the Crime Prevention Research Center says, okay, from 1995 to 2005, the firearm homicide rate in Connecticut did drop from 3.13 deaths per 100,000 people to 1.88 per 100,000 people. But Dr. Lott says unexplained is that the firearms homicide rate was falling even faster before that law went into effect. From 1993 to 1995, he says, the firearm homicide rate fell from 4.5 to 3.13 per 100,000 residents, a 30% drop in just 2 years. He said that represented a greater decline than the 17% national decline over those 2 years. And when you look at the actual crime data for the state of Connecticut, you find out some interesting things as well. Because to my mind, I think most of us are more concerned about violent crime, right? We don't necessarily care how it's being committed. We care that people are dying. We care that people are being injured. We care that there are home invasions. So 1994, which is when this law went into effect in Connecticut, the homicide rate was 6.6 per 100,000 people. As of 2016, it was down to 2.2 per 100,000 people, which is fantastic news. It did go up and down. You had a fluctuation in the violent crime and in the homicide rate in Connecticut. But this also tracks what happened nationally between 1994 and, let's say, 2016 or 2014. For 25 years across the country, we saw violent crime drop. In 1991, the U.S. homicide rate was at 9.8 per 100,000 people. 9.8. And then it started dropping. 9.3, climbed up a bit in 93 to 9.5, then down to 9, 8.2, 7.4, 6.8, 6.3, 5.7. We saw the national homicide rate get cut in half from 1991 to 2014. 9.8 to 4.4 homicides per 100,000 people. Now, again, that's more than a 50% decline in the homicide rate around the country. And that happened not while there was all kinds of new federal gun control legislation on the books. Actually, no, that happened while there were millions of Americans who were becoming legal gun owners who were exercising their right to keep and bear arms. This happened while states across the country were adopting not the may issue laws that are in place in Maryland, but the shall issue laws, the concealed carry laws that have allowed, I think the last report was, 15 million Americans to obtain their concealed carry license. While that was taking place, while the NRA was, quote, running roughshod over American politics, what was happening? Yeah, the violent crime rate was plummeting. The homicide rate was plummeting. I mean, again, it wasn't just homicide, down from 9.8 to 4.4. Violent crime in general. 1991, 758 violent crimes per 100,000 people. By 2014, that number had declined to 372 violent crimes per 100,000 people. That's amazing. And gun control at the federal level, at the state level, really not an issue. So what was going on? Well, again, if you listen to the anti-gun activists, it all has to be based to some sort of gun control law. If you actually look at what was going on at the state-by-state level, and you look at what was going on, actually, what happened the last time we had a big piece of federal anti-gun legislation, which I would consider to be the Gun Control Act of 1968. You know what happened in the 10 years after the Gun Control Act of 1968 went on the books? In 1968, the homicide rate in the United States, 6.9 per 100,000 people. Violent crime, 298 violent crimes per 100,000 people. 10 years later, 1978, homicide rate was 9 per 100,000 people. Violent crime, up to 498 violent crimes per 100,000 people. That's a decade after you had sweeping federal gun control legislation put on the books. Violent crime went up. And again, going back to the 90s, I guess you could say that, you know, you had the Clinton gun ban that went into effect in 94, lasted for 10 years. But the drop in violent crime actually began before that gun ban went into effect, continued after the gun ban ended. And frankly, you and I, and even the researchers know, the firearms that were banned weren't used in a lot of crimes before the ban went into effect, weren't used in a lot of crimes during the ban, and weren't used in a lot of crimes after the ban. But for the gun control advocates, again, there always has to be that gun control answer to why this is happening, even if the data doesn't reflect that. All right, we're going to step away for a moment or two. When we come back, Andrew Langer with the Institute for Liberty joins us. So stick around, just getting started here on this Tuesday edition of Cam and Company.
Speaking to Peter Churchborn about NRA online hunter education. Peter, welcome. Tell us, what's it all about?
So at the NRA, I'm sure a lot of you know that we do a lot of programs to help hunters in the United States. But about 3 years ago in the Hunter Services Department, we decided we wanted to do something to help the dwindling numbers of hunters getting into this industry. So as you might know, the NRA started hunter education in 1949. We were the organization that supplied all the training to new hunters for almost 22 years in the United States. So it was just natural that we got back into the business of hunter education. So for the past 3 years, we've been developing a new all-encompassing online hunter education course that we are going to give away free to every person in the United States that want to take hunter education.
Wow. Sounds like a good deal. So tell us, Peter, a little bit about the program.
Sure. So there is standards that's set by the industry of what hunter education has to be delivered in every state. Every state also has a little bit different twist on how they want it delivered in their state, but we're willing to develop anything that they need into our online course. Currently, our online course is available in Florida and soon to be coming in Oregon. We've only had it launched for 60 days, and we hope to have about seven states using our course in their state in the next 5 months.
That's awesome. Speaking with Peter Churchborn, NRA online hunter education, exciting prospects. So, Peter, this will continue to grow, and we'll continue to follow that growth with you. So how can people get more information about the program?
Sure. It's very easy. Go to www.nrahe.org. That's the landing page, and it will direct you to every state that we have and any more information that you might need.
Excellent. Peter Churchborn, NRA Online Hunter Education, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on the program.
To the ungrateful who unjustly condemn America's police force, your shallow criticism doesn't define the brave who wear the badge. Their courage speaks for itself. In an era where many profit from passing the buck, our police are the first to step up. When their fellow Americans come under threat, they don't stop to take a public opinion poll. A rare breed who embrace long hours and a thankless job. It's in their blood to defend men, women, and children of every race and background. They even protect the ungrateful, the ones who are quick to criticize, but even quicker to dial 911 when they are afraid. Here's a message to the media, the self-serving politicians, and the Hollywood hypocrites who condemn America's police. What makes you think anyone wants to hear your elitist, uninformed opinions? These are our brothers and sisters, sons and daughters. They are our parents and neighbors, scoutmasters, church leaders, PTA presidents and volunteers. They serve our communities and country with dignity and honor. Every day, they leave for work and kiss their families goodbye, knowing it could be the last time they do so. The NRA has the backs of those willing to take on violent criminals to protect our values and way of life. We commend the courage of those who wear the badge, especially in this time when their bravery has come under scrutiny. Ungrateful critics may seem loud. Your courage under fire is deafening.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Scott Bach from the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs is going to join us on the program in just a little bit. Right now, I want to welcome from the Institute for Liberty, Mr. Andrew Langer is with us on the show. Andrew, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, getting all set for the festivities to commence.
Festivity. Oh, yes, Thanksgiving coming up in a couple of days. Are you doing any particular special dish this year? Because I know how much you love to cook.
Well, it's funny. So my mom, who, as I was telling Cameron Gray, is 72 and has Parkinson's and arthritis, she's insisting on cooking just about everything herself. I will be allowed to carve the turkey. I'm very excited about this. But she has also deigned to allow me to make a green bean almondine dish that my girls love. And I'm going to surprise everybody by doing a homemade creamed corn, which is a really simple dish. You'll appreciate this, Cam. I'm going to use guanciale, jowl bacon, as the bacon in my creamed corn this year.
Nice. Very nice. Excited. All right. Well, I got a text from my wife who said, do you like cream of pumpkin soup? And I said, I've never had that, but I'm game to try it. So bring it on. So I guess we're having cream of pumpkin soup as one of our side dishes here for Thanksgiving this year. And then speaking of bacon, this weekend, Andrew, we're going to be processing three of our hogs. So
excellent.
We'll have some fresh bacon here before long. Yes. Very excited about that.
I'm very excited. I hope I can get my hands on some of it. Yeah, we're pretty pumped. Actually, it's going to be kind of fun because my brothers were out shooting on the Eastern Shore last weekend. They bagged four geese, so they may be bringing a goose down. And I'm hopefully going to be put in charge of making that on either Friday or Saturday. It may wind up going into the turkey fryer, but I may wind up doing a slow roast like a confit. So I'm pretty pumped for that.
Excellent. Well, listen, I wish you and yours a very happy Thanksgiving. And in the meantime, what's going on with net neutrality here? The FCC has made a big decision. But what does it mean for consumers? What does it mean for the industry?
Well, I mean, listen, what they're doing is they're slowly but surely rolling up the decisions of the Obama administration. Remember, the Obama administration was really trying to mount a massive federal takeover of the internet. And listen, like everything else the Obama administration did, they really burrowed in with what they were trying to do. So step by step, Chairman Ajit Pai and the other conservative free market members of the FCC are pushing back against this. What it means is that those who are delivering our internet services will be able to recoup any investment that they make. Right. The problem with federal regulation and essentially the nationalization of our internets was going to be that there was going to be very little guarantee that anybody who was going to invest in infrastructure in the future was going to be able to recoup that investment. And why would you invest in something? Why would you invest in improving something unless you could recoup your investment down the road? ROI, return on investment. And so what this means is we will continue to see the gains that we've gotten in the 20 plus years since Al Gore invented the internet, all of that massive a technological advancement that can continue. A lot of that was in jeopardy under what the Obama administration was doing. Now we're going to see some real innovation that can actually occur.
All right. Now, opponents of this are saying things like, okay, well, this means that the big companies, the big providers are going to be able to throttle what you use, throttle back certain websites, right? I mean, they're saying that this is going to lead to more restrictions on consumers. Why are they wrong?
Okay, so what happens is essentially what we're talking about is getting what you pay for. If you pay for the highest level of internet service, you should be able to get that service. And if you're a web company, if you are a company that provides some sort of content on the web, and you pay to have blazingly fast speeds delivered to your end users, your consumers, your viewers, your listeners, or whatever, you should be able to pay extra for that. What the other side is talking about is if you don't want to pay for that service, then the internet company has the right to deliver a slower, more basic speed. They don't like that. They think that if you're, Joe's web show, done out of somebody's basement in Tarzana, California, you should get the same rates as the folks who are producing excellent materials in a studio in St. Louis, let's say, and are paying X number of dollars to have that out there. That's not the way a marketplace works. Someone who's providing services should be able to charge for different tiers of services. Now, what consumers might want to worry about is not reading the fine print, right? So, like, when you buy a certain, platinum level AT&T plan, you should know that unlimited doesn't really mean unlimited. It means that after you use 20 gigs of service, they may slow down your speed a little bit. That's just called being a good, smart, savvy consumer. And the reality is, as the internet improves, the number of teraflops that you wind up using, that will all get included. It's really interesting, Cam, because, it was in the late 80s, maybe the mid 80s, that author Arthur C. Clarke predicted that that eventually long distance rates were going to go to essentially zero, right? It took the deregulation of the long distance industry in order for that to happen, right? You had the same kinds of people decrying and, insisting on net neutrality, decrying the deregulation of long distance companies back in the late 80s and into the early 90s. But here we are, almost 30 years later, and Arthur C. Clarke's vision has come true.
That's true. You're right. It has. And we were talking about this, I think, with Seton Motley last week about rural broadband, because that's another big push right now. And, I said, look, when I moved and left Northern Virginia 5 years ago and we moved to, middle of nowhere, Central Virginia, we have satellite internet. Like, that was our option. If we lived closer to the road and we had closer neighbors, maybe we could get cable. But we don't and we can't. So we're stuck with satellite. And I've seen just over the past what we were stuck with was a combination of satellite and wireless. Yeah. And over the past 5 years, I've seen both get better, exponentially better. As a matter of fact, we just upgraded our satellite internet. I had to have the guy come back out this past weekend because we had paid for the upgrade and we weren't seeing better service. Got it taken care of. And all of a sudden now we are going from, 2 megabytes per second download to 20 to 25. Right. And at the same time, our wireless internet has gotten better. I mean, these things have progressed. And so we're talking, this plan that was going to be like $62 billion, I think, for rural broadband. And I'm just thinking to myself, I'm not sure that I get that, because here I am. I'm one of those that was stuck with, the quote unquote subpar internet. But I've seen through private investment and through the free market, exactly, the improvement in those services just over the past 5 years. So I would conceivably stand to benefit from some sort of government provided rural broadband, but I'm not sure that it's necessary, because I've seen it get better.
It's not. And let me add to that this, right? I mean, think about this. Think about the infrastructure projects that you've seen in and around Farmville and how hard it is to get those infrastructure projects improved over time. So basically what happens, Cam, is, a local community invests in rural broadband for their town, and then you are locked into whatever the technology is under which that's built for a massive period of time. I couldn't even tell you how long that time is. Whereas in that time, if there is competition, market, right, you underscored it well. Your two competitors for your service are your wireless company on the one hand and your satellite provider on the other. Those two competing with one another to deliver the best, fastest, easily accessible internet speeds, they're going to fight for your business, even if you're using both of them. But they're going to fight for it. Whereas the rural broadband, they would have to compete, but they wouldn't be able to because of the constraints that are put on government. And so, it is a lose-lose proposition. I mean, it really is a great lie. It's one of the big lies of the left that you need this sort of rural broadband investment, which you really do not.
Well, I mean, like, to me, it seems like this, one of the big arguments is, if you're not happy with something, let government do it.
Yes.
It'll always be better, right? And that's the thing, like, I can be unsatisfied with what I'm getting from private enterprise. That doesn't mean that I'm automatically going to, jump into the arms of Uncle Sam and say, take care of me, Uncle Sam. I don't see that. I don't see how one equates to the other.
Well, and let's think about this, right? If there is a real market for it, somebody is going to find a way to bring that mousetrap to your door. And you know, because right, if it wasn't satellite and it wasn't cellular provided internet, you know, then I'm seeing now ads for these guys that are trying to build the. I don't know if you've seen them. The ads for the guys who are trying to build the network of wireless that's all mounted on commercial airliners, so that somehow creates the network. It's kind of an ingenious idea, right? So, you know, there are always folks who are thinking about this. Mark Zuckerberg talking about autonomous drones flying over Central Africa. Not that I'm a huge fan of Mark Zuckerberg, but again, trying to find ways to deliver that experience. Listen, to me, there was nothing more amazing. It was 7 years ago in about 2 weeks that I was in the deserts of Algeria visiting the Sahrawi refugee camps. And as it happened, this is a quick story, as it happened, my best friend growing up, his father died, and I was spending a lot of time on the phone in the Sahara Desert to help my friend make his funeral arrangements for his dad. And I got to tell you, Cam, I was getting better cell service in the middle of the Sahara Desert in Algeria than I was in certain areas of D.C.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, see, That's pretty amazeballs. And I imagine now you'd probably even be able to get faster internet in the middle of nowhere, Algeria.
Yes, so I'd be able to actually call for help now.
There you go. You see, and so one day I know that I'm going to figure out the mystery of how it is that I can get great cell phone reception downstairs, but upstairs in my house, I get nothing. I'll figure that out. Maybe I just need to move my house to Algeria. Andrew, listen, unfortunately, we got to take a time out, but I want to wish you and yours again a very happy Thanksgiving. I hope that you get to celebrate it with all your family, and look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Likewise, Cam. So give my best to everybody there.
I certainly will. Andrew Langer with the Institute for Liberty on Twitter at Andrew_Langer. And as we take a break, let me just say again, thank you so much for all of the thoughts and the prayers and the well wishes that I have just, I mean, honestly been overwhelmed with over the past couple of days. I told you on Friday we got some news about my wife and her cancer coming back, and don't have anything new to report in that regard. We'll know more in early December, but we're after, you know, honestly, after like 24 hours of freaking out, and it was hard not to freak out for about 24 hours, we're positive. We're going to fight. We're going to keep going. We know that we've got, again, the thoughts and prayers of folks literally all around the world right now who are keeping us in their thoughts and prayers. And that means a lot to us. So thank you again for sharing those kind words, because I heard from so many folks via email or Twitter. And I just can't thank you enough for that. All right. When we come back, Scott Bock's going to join us, NRA board member, head of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs. And we'll talk about what's going on in North Jersey with a number of communities now voting. I don't know what good it's going to do, but they're going on the record, at least their elected officials are, as being opposed to the National Right to Carry Reciprocity Act. We'll talk about it with Scott right after this. So stick around.
Speaking with Christina Krawczyk with NRA Field Ops Division. Christina, welcome back to the program. Good to have you back. Now,
always a pleasure.
I love it. I love when I get to talk to you about things like this. Coming up in November, there's a new thing, a great new phenomenon called Giving Tuesday. It's Tuesday, November 28th. But you folks over at NRA Field Ops are doing something special with Giving Tuesday. Tell us what's going on.
That's right. November 28th is Giving Tuesday. It's been around for a long time, but this is the first year that we've actually done a campaign. Now, we started the campaign October 24th, and the campaign is about stories of yes, because 100% of the proceeds are benefiting the Yes Scholarship Fund this year. So with that campaign, what we did is we took a look at some of our Yes alums. They all do phenomenal things in their community. So these are stories of giving, and we had an incredible Yes student this year that a couple of them actually that are writers. And so we had the Yes alum write stories about Yes alum on stories of giving. So those are each being posted on NRA blog each week. And it's a call to action to come donate for the cause. Now, we're going to be running this campaign through the end of November 28th at midnight. And this is a friendly competition because you know that field ops are highly competitive with raising money.
No.
So, yeah, I know. It's shocking, right? So we're actually going by regions to see who can raise the most money, and that includes headquarters right here. So we are moving and grooving.
I like that.
And so far, we've been up, I guess we're about 6,000. Our goal is 10,000. Now, when you look at $10,000, you have to think about the scholarship fund because after a week of yes, we dole out scholarship money. And this year it was almost $22,000. They were phenomenal. And the only reason we were able to do that is because one of the executives gave $5,000 out of his own pocket. So we were able to give a lot of scholarships this year. So we really hope that people read the NRA blog articles, the stories of giving about our Yes alums, and pony up because these are our leaders of tomorrow.
So, Christina, tell us, what is the Yes program?
The Yes program is an incredible program that's been around for 21 years. It is a one-week educational fellowship. It is highly competitive to get in. So right now, applications are open, and we will close those on January 12th. What we do is we're looking for the cream of the crop. We're looking for kids that are, or students, I should say, that are highly involved in academics, leadership, and community service. They have to go through quite an application process, and then we take a look, and we've got five people going through all of those applications, and a lot of times it comes down to their essays. We pick about 40 to 45. They come here for a week to spend with us. We take them to NRA. They learn about the programs. We take them to the range to shoot. We take them into D.C. to see museums. They have discussions on topics going on in the country, as well as debates. And what we're looking for are those leaders. And we are watching them all week long. And that's how we end up giving out those scholarships on awards night. This is a life-changing week for these kids. You will hear it time and time again. It's incredible. It's incredible.
So it's Giving Tuesday, November 28th, but the campaign is going on now. So check it out.
It's going on right now.
Incredible stories and stuff to see. How can we get more information, Christina?
You can go to the link. You're going to go to friendsofnra.org/givingtuesday, and that's going to give you a button to donate. And like I said, this is a competition, so it's going to ask you if there was anyone who suggested the donation or the Giving Tuesday. You can mark their name down. I'm happy to say Christina Krawczyk is on there. You can totally use my name.
Oh, awesome. I love that. So before we let you go, just give us in about 30 seconds, share a little bit of one of those stories. We had mentioned that before we started the interview.
I would love to. Emily Brooks, she was an alum from 2016, and it's written by Jameson Sapp, who was one of our students from 2017. And I love this beginning paragraph that Jameson writes about Emily. As an NRA Youth Education Summit alum, one thing I can state without a doubt is that every single Yes participant has a passion for their country, community, and fellow citizens. Emily Brooks is a wonderful example of how that passion gets turned into action. Since attending the program in 2016, Emily has continued to give back to her community by supporting Operation Welcome Home in her home state of Illinois. The nonprofit organization works to honor veterans coming home from deployment and help support them in the transition back to civilian life.
Welcome back, and thanks again for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company. We will be off, by the way, Thanksgiving and the day after. Cameron, we'll see what we get tomorrow. I know it gets increasingly difficult to book a show here on a holiday week, so we might just be pulling in, like, you know, passersby on the street tomorrow afternoon as everybody is taking off. But I tell you what, right now, we've got a great show for you today. Scott Bach, NRA board member, executive director of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, is with us on the program. Scott, how are you, sir?
Hey, Cam, great to be back. Speaking of passersby.
Well, listen, you know that you've always got a space here on the program. And, you know, we haven't talked with you since the election. And unfortunately, both in Virginia and in New Jersey, we saw gun control advocates make big gains. And I know that we're going to be feeling this in the years to come, both in Virginia and New Jersey. We're sort of New Jersey South in Virginia. That's what I'm getting scared about. But there are several towns in New Jersey that are now passing these resolutions against the National Right to Carry Reciprocity Act. NorthJersey.com says at least half a dozen North Jersey towns have adopted resolutions opposing the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act of 2017. Fort Lee Mayor Mark Sokolich said, if anyone's going to have a concealed weapon, it should be based on an application that should be made to the appropriate authority in New Jersey. I'll be damned if a state with liberality hands out concealed gun permits, and I've got them in my town every day. Well, I'm curious, Scott, what other rights should I give up when I go to Fort Lee, New Jersey?
Right. Well, apparently all of them. Listen, what a coincidence that all these towns are suddenly passing these resolutions at the same time. It's just amazing how synchronicity just happens that way by itself, isn't it, Cam?
It is crazy how that works. Yeah.
Look, here's what's really going on. Okay, you know, as you've heard me say many times, the folks in New Jersey, those in power in New Jersey, are going to have to be dragged kicking and screaming into the post-Heller and McDonald era, particularly on right to carry. They see what's happening nationally. They smell what's coming down the pike on carry with reciprocity, and they're gearing up for it, okay? Not just to pass meaningless resolutions, but they're thinking ahead. And we all know that when national reciprocity passes, in whatever form it passes, it's going to be challenged by places like New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they're doing now, in my opinion, is they're laying the groundwork for these legal challenges. Okay. Instead of being silent, they're trying to lay groundwork that they will then cite to in their legal papers, you know, talking about how, as a matter of public policy, you know, that they're going to cite the resolutions of these many towns in their legal papers as one of their layered arguments. Okay. That they're gearing up for battle. You know, like we're gearing up for battle in New Jersey, New Jersey is gearing up for battle nationally. And, you know, things are going to be rocking and rolling nationally, in my opinion, when we see at least one more pro-gun U.S. Supreme Court justice. Things are going to really pick up, and then you're going to see the litigation come flying. And hopefully, and I'm more than hopeful about it. I mean, I understand the tactic and strategy, but you know, we're going to see the U.S. Supreme Court eventually rule the way they should rule on this issue. And those little towns are going to just have to deal with it.
Well,
you know,
and
they're stuck in the 90s. They're stuck with the idea that lawful, trained, vetted citizens carrying firearms are a danger to public safety. That's their mindset, Cam.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, I know that these resolutions that have been passed in North Jersey have objected to, you know, national right to carry reciprocity. But, ultimately what they're objecting to, Scott, are not just people from, you know, out of state coming in and being able to exercise their Second Amendment rights. They don't think you, living in New Jersey, have any Second Amendment rights. I mean, it's not there in your state constitution. And you and I have talked about this before. It's not like the state has gone back and changed its gun laws after the Heller or the McDonald decisions. New Jersey's gun laws are written in such a way that it's not a right. It is a privilege that you get permission to have a firearm in your home. You get extra special permission to carry a firearm if you're lucky, but it's not seen as a right.
You're absolutely right. And you know, while we did make some gains under the Christie administration when they slightly expanded through executive action, but, you know, the standard to qualify for a carry permit, which mm-hmm. is justifiable need in the Garden State, you know, we saw a massive overreaction by anti-gun legislators who are now suing the governor to try to overturn the regulation that was promulgated pursuant to the governor's executive order. So, you know, they will not give an inch. They will have to be dragged into this era, and it's going to take, ultimately, in my opinion, the U.S. Supreme Court to do it. And, you know, they're going to kick and scream and yell and complain and whine and litigate and get in the way every possible chance they can. They are absolutely hostile to Second Amendment rights generally, and particularly the right to carry, which, as we all know, is the right to defend your life with a firearm outside your home. Everyone agrees inside your home you can defend your life. Somehow these towns seem to think that your life is less valuable the moment you walk out your front door. It's absurd. It's crazy, and it's going to end. And they know it, and that's why they're starting to protest.
Talking again with Scott Bach, Executive Director of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, a member of the NRA, a member of the NRA's Board of Directors as well. And Scott, I'll give you another quote here. Teaneck, New Jersey Councilman Alan Sohn said reciprocity between states makes sense in some cases. He couldn't tell you what cases those would be. But he says gun laws should be under local control, which is odd because I bet that this councilman would also say that there needs to be all kinds of new federal gun regulations, even though gun laws should be under local control. He said, quote, if some states have a lower driving age, I'm okay with them driving in New Jersey. But in some states, he says, any adult over the age of 18 can get a permit for a gun, which, no, I think someone needs to talk with the council member there, because, again, you have to be a legal gun owner in order to carry, even in constitutional carry states. If you can't legally possess that firearm, you can't legally carry it. So I'm kind of curious. I mean, what is that rationale of, well, yeah, you know, driving, driver's licenses, there are different standards from state to state. That's okay. But when it comes to something that is actually in the Bill of Rights as an individual right, that's when we think that, you know, states or localities should be able to just, shut that right down.
It's pure hypocrisy, Cam. You know, you can't have it both ways. I mean, it's amazing how these folks talk out of both sides of their mouth, depending on the issue. You know, they either hide behind the Constitution or hide behind states' rights, and they pick and choose and switch in a heartbeat, and it just exposes the blatant hypocrisy. And listen, this agenda to end the right to defend yourself with a firearm, the right to own firearms, unfortunately, that agenda is alive and well in places like New Jersey, and there are people trying to spread that like an infection, and it is really, really important that, you know, while we have Congress and while we have the presidency, you know, in the pro-gun corner, that this infection be eradicated permanently, okay? You know, if you let the folks in New Jersey run things, if you let that spread, I mean, the rest of the country cannot imagine what would be coming. I mean, we are fighting on the front lines, tip of the spear, whatever you want to call it. Every day is a battle just to own guns in a place like New Jersey. And don't think for a second that if, you know, others could bring that to your state, they wouldn't try, because they would. There is a movement that just wants to, you know, this, whatever it is, a social movement, private gun ownership is not compatible with statism. You know, when the state is in charge, you can't have the citizens able to defend themselves. That has to be eradicated once and for all. And, you know, places like New Jersey are going to cling until they're forced to accept the truth.
So how concerned are you? I mean, I kind of half jokingly said, you know, Virginia, I'm concerned, is going to turn into South Jersey here before long. I mean, we did just elect the most anti-gun gubernatorial candidate that the state of Virginia has ever seen. I can see that governor-elect Ralph Northam working closely with his counterpart in New Jersey to try to push similar gun control laws. I imagine, you know, it's very likely we're going to see our reciprocity agreements once again get struck down by our Attorney General Mark Herring. And this time I don't think you'll see the governor step in to try to come up with a fix here in New Jersey. So how concerned are you, or here in Virginia, how concerned are you about what this incoming administration is going to mean, not just for gun owners who might visit New Jersey and mistakenly bring their firearm in? How concerned are you about what this new administration is going to mean for gun owners in New Jersey?
Well, we're gearing up for major battle. It's not a mystery what their agenda is. It's laid out in black and white. We've known it. We battled it as much as we could in the election, but it wasn't enough. And we're going to have to battle it as it comes up. I mean, we're expecting things to be introduced and to, you know, see the light of day before the end of the current session. Okay. You know, the new governor doesn't take office until January 16th, but we're expecting the onslaught to begin now, you know, and so we're gearing up for major battle at multiple levels. That means at the grassroots level. It means at the lawsuit level. It means pretty much at every level we're capable of. I mean, it's all hands on deck right now. We are gearing up for major battle. We're going to need support from the rest of the country. And trust me, if you don't contain it in places like New Jersey and Virginia, it will spread. So, you know, we're going to do what we've always done. We're going to fight on the front lines with every ounce of strength and smarts that we have. We're going to, you know, we've survived against incredible odds in the past in New Jersey. And we are going to do our best to deal with everything that is coming and to thwart, delay, stall, get in the way of, and then ultimately challenge and defeat whatever's coming.
Scott Bach, again, Executive Director of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, member of the NRA's Board of Directors as well. Scott, listen, thank you so much for coming on the program. Hope you have a very happy Thanksgiving, and we'll be talking again soon.
Thanks, Cam. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, sir. All right. Scott Bach with us here on Cam and Company. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom joining us next hour for this week's Liberty Update. Also, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins will join us from Breitbart. Meanwhile, Boston Globe reporting Brandeis University. You know, we were just talking about Brandeis. Was it last week? Brandeis University putting the brakes on a play that was written by a visiting professor there at Brandeis, all about free speech on college campuses. Apparently that just cut too close to the bone for Brandeis, so they had to cancel that play. Brandeis is also a gun-free zone, but oddly enough, that hasn't stopped armed robberies from occurring on campus. We'll talk about that after a quick timeout, so stick around. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It's on the way right after this.
Speaking with Dirk Grohl with NRA Store, it's the holiday season coming upon us. Let's talk about some great new stuff from NRAStore.com. What do we have for Christmas?
Well, as you said, it's the holiday season, and this first product is our limited edition holiday mug. That mug is specially made for the NRA, and we've only made 400 of those this year, and we're about halfway through. It's handmade in the USA, hand-thrown on a pottery wheel, and then it's hand-glazed with a beautiful, rich red glaze. And we have a special ornament that's attached, and it has Santa and his reindeer. And on the bottom, we have NRA limited edition.
It's the first item on my list for Christmas, Dirk. Thank you. That's great.
Yeah.
So that's the
very
mug.
Popular.
What else do we have Christmas-wise? I think, what do we have, an ornament?
Our 2017 ornament. This is limited to 1,000 copies, and we're down to around 600 right now, so there's still some left.
Right.
But it's Santa's sleigh this year. That's the theme, with some greenery. It says National Rifle Association with a lot of gifts, but the most important gift in there is our rifle.
So for Christmas specifically, we have the mug and the ornament. So, but there's other new items, and you and I were talking a little before we got on the air here, and you got some really neat stuff. So show us that unique challenge coin that you have.
We made a unique challenge coin, something we've never seen before. This one is solid bronze. It's 39 millimeters. It's made in the USA. But the people that make these for us, they make these, and then they take them outside with a .223 AR-15, and they shoot a hole in them, and then they burnish the edges so you can tell all your friends this is the size hole that a .223 makes.
So they actually, Dirk, take those out and shoot a hole in them.
It's actually shot with an actual rifle, and there's little rough edges that are there. They burn it, buff those so they don't tear your pants pocket, but it's really cool, and it's 1995.
Dude, that's a great idea. I love that. All right, what else do we have?
We have a new pistol safe. It has the NRA. Let me turn it around so you can see it. It has the NRA logo on it, and as you can see, it is just about the right size for a full-size 1911. But this is really cool, and it's different than other pistol safes because, as you can see, it does have a push-button operation. 1,500 possible combinations, but we call it the EMP-proof pistol vault because it doesn't require any batteries, no electricity, and you can just program in any of one of those 1,500 possible four-digit combinations, and you're set if there's ever a denial of service or a power outage or, you know, some kind of catastrophic event.
Anything. So it's so you want to put your fully non-battery powered device. Don't put your smart gun in there, but your actual revolver or your handgun in there, and it's totally accessible, and nothing's going to keep you from getting your firearm if you need it. I love that.
Exactly, and it's got a handle on it, and you can take it with you anywhere you want to go.
That's nice. Yeah. Portable, too. An EMP-proof gun safe. I love it. And what else? I think we have one more new item. Tell us about that, Dirk.
You know when you go to the range, and you're shooting away, and it's a hot day, and all of a sudden you think, you know what I forgot? I forgot to bring bottles of water. Well, we've solved that problem with this new
conceal carry cooler. This cooler will hold 12 canned beverages, and it's a really good cooler. We actually tested this. Our team took ice cubes and filled this up, and we closed it up, and 36 hours later, we still had ice cubes.
Wow.
So we know it works great. Don't forget that it has a holster and mag pouches that come with it.
Awesome.
Really nice item.
Dirk Grove, NRAstore.com. That's where you get all the info. Love this stuff. Get over there and do your holiday shopping. Thanks, Dirk, for being on the program. We'll talk to you soon.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company. Fueled by Hornady starts right this second. On the program this hour, Mr. Tim Lee from the Center for Individual Freedom. AWR Hawkins from Breitbart will join us as well about an hour from now. We have today's hero of the day, our deal of the day. Good guy as well. At Brandeis University, as I said, the school appears to have a problem with the First Amendment. I mean, well, you know, look, this is a private university. They can do what they want. But it was just a couple of weeks ago we were talking about this play that a visiting professor had written using material there at Brandeis University, some of the papers from Lenny Bruce, the comedian. And this professor had written a play about what would happen if Lenny Bruce tried to speak on the Brandeis campus today and what would the reaction be. And apparently even writing about that is verboten because the play was shut down, not allowed to take place there on the campus at Brandeis. So not too keen on freedom of speech there, Brandeis. Really not keen on your right to keep and bear arms. Obviously, Brandeis is a gun-free zone. The armed robbers there who committed an armed robbery on the campus last night appear neither to have gotten the message, or perhaps they just don't care that Brandeis University is a gun-free zone. Boston Globe reports that Brandeis will review its safety protocols after two men, one of them armed with a handgun, menaced three students in their dorm room, an act that triggered a campus-wide lockdown that lasted for about 2 hours. Campus police alerted to an armed robbery that took place Monday night in the East Quad. Police activated security protocols that included the lockdown. University tweeted, armed subject on campus, take shelter, lock doors, windows, silent cell, remain quiet. Don't let anyone in the room until okayed by authorities. The lockdown lifted around 2 o'clock in the morning when a campus-wide search ended without discovering any of these suspects. According to a statement by Public Safety Director Edward Callahan and Jim Gray, who's Brandeis's Vice President of Campus Operations, three students were in their dorm room when the two men, who are not students, entered the room and robbed the student. The statement says one suspect threatened three students in the room with a gun, then both fled campus. University police have since concluded that the incident was linked to at least one of these students and there is no campus-wide security threat. Okay. Except to the, you know, folks there in that dorm room. Not just Brandeis, though. Mm-mm. Nope. WXYZ in Detroit with a story from, this was over the weekend, an armed robbery at the Buffalo Wild Wings on the campus of the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor has students on edge and police searching for two men. This is a double gun-free zone, by the way, because not only is the University of Michigan a gun-free zone, but Buffalo Wild Wings are also gun-free zones as well. So this was a double gun-free zone, and yet still the armed robbers just blew right by both of those gun-free zones. Unreal. Kelly Fletcher, a college sophomore living nearby, says it's a little concerning. Yeah, it is. I would think. WXYZ says Ann Arbor police, no description of the suspects. Both dressed in hoodies, had covered their faces with masks. Another student, junior Saren Joyce, says, really surprising. Usually crime's farther away, but for this, it's so close. He lives steps away from the Buffalo Wild Wings, where police said the two men entered the location from a rear door in the back alley. Lieutenant Matthew Lidge with the Ann Arbor Police Department confirmed one of the robbers brandished a firearm. The two got away with about $2,000. Police also say the robbery happened so quickly that some employees closing in the front of the store had no idea that they had been robbed. Lieutenant Lidge stated that police are hoping that tips can lead to an arrest. WXYZ in Detroit says, meanwhile, students on campus say they will remain extra cautious until police solve this case. I gotta tell those students, you know, even after the police solve this case, I'd still be extra cautious because those aren't the only two criminals there in Ann Arbor, Michigan. As if that wasn't enough, Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Armed robbery involving three subjects at the Point at Raiders campus apartments. Now, this just off campus in Murfreesboro. This was Sunday night, just before 7 in the evening. Victim told police when returning to her apartment, she and a subject in a silver Chevy Suburban attempted to park in the same space. She ends up finding another spot. She says a guy walked up to her to ask for directions. After she answered the questions, the suspect brandished a gun, told her to give him her purse. Then she said another suspect came up behind him, also with a gun. After taking the victim's purse, they fled. Detectives have taken over the investigation in the armed robbery. They're just off campus in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Again, it's the weirdest thing. It's almost like these armed robbers don't care what the campus policies are regarding bringing a firearm on campus. It's almost like they have the idea that they can go on campus armed with a gun illegally, commit an armed robbery, and then scoot away before they're going to get caught. And maybe that's because in all three of these cases, at least so far, no subjects have been apprehended. Now, thankfully, again, in none of these cases were students hurt. But that's kind of up to the armed robber at that point, isn't it? It's not really up to the students. It's not really up to law enforcement who aren't there to respond while this armed robbery is taking place. No, again, at this point, you're just basically putting your health and your life in the hands of those who are robbing you. Now, one other op-ed. We talked last hour about this op-ed of the Kansas City Star, trying to make the case that Missouri's gun control laws or Missouri's pro-gun laws have led to this staggering increase in violent crime. Well, why? Just look at what Connecticut did, and oh my goodness gracious, they were able to reduce all kinds of gun control laws. There's another piece by a gentleman in Oregon, Pamplin Media. Paul Kemp is the founding member of Gun Owners for Responsible Ownership, also an advisory member of the Giffords Oregon Coalition. And he took to the pages of the Portland Tribune to talk about Oregon's gun control laws, specifically Kate Brown. He said in her very first year in office, Governor Brown took on the, quote, corporate gun lobby and passed a, quote, common sense bill that closed a major gap in Oregon law that let dangerous people buy guns without a background check. And after closing the, quote, background check loophole, he says, Brown took up the issue of guns and domestic violence, helping to pass critical legislation that closed a loophole in Oregon law that allowed domestic violence misdemeanors to legally possess firearms. And he says, as the 2018 gubernatorial race begins to heat up, the stakes in this election, he says, could not be higher, and the differences between the two candidates could not be starker. He writes, well, Governor Brown has been called a leader by U.S. Representative Gabrielle Giffords for her work championing responsible gun safety laws. Her opponent, Newt Bueller, has said that laws won't make a difference. So I did, again, take a look at what's been going on with violent crime in Oregon over the past couple of years. And, you know, Oregon, again, not much different than a lot of states around the country. Violent crime in Oregon was dropping fairly steadily. The decline in violent crime in Oregon came later than it did for the country as a whole back in the early 1990s. It really wasn't until like 1995 you started to see a drop in violent crime. Nationally, you started to see that drop occur in 1991. 1995 in Oregon, the homicide rate was 4.9, 1994, homicide rate 4.9 per 100,000 people. Violent crime, 520 per 100,000 people. And by 2013, violent crime had dropped to 242 crimes per 100,000 people. Homicide rate had dropped to 2.1. And then again, like we've seen in a lot of states around the nation, starting about 2015, violent crime started going up again. Drop. It had been dropping before Governor Brown took office, continued to drop after Governor Brown took office. And then while Governor Brown was in office, violent crime started going up in Oregon. Homicide rate, 2014 was 2.1 per 100,000 people. 2015, up to 2.7. 2016, up to 2.8, which is the highest homicide rate that the state of Oregon has had since 1998. Violent crime, as I said, 2013 was 242.8. And then starting in 2014, ticked up 259.2, 2015 up to 265.4, 2016 basically steady 264.6. So almost the same level of violent crime in 2016 as 2015. But the years of declines in violent crime stopped in 2014. That was it. That was the last year. And then 2015, 2016, you started seeing those numbers go up. Now, again, this is not happening in every state around the country. There are states that saw their crime rate continue to drop. But nationally, 2015 is, again, when we started to see our national crime rate arrested slide and start going in the opposite direction, going in the wrong direction. So what's going on here? I mean, again, the violent crime rate has increased even in these states that have passed all kinds of gun control laws. We're going to talk again in Hour 3 with Derek Hunter from WBAL in Baltimore, Maryland, where you've got universal background check laws on the books. You've got a quote-unquote assault weapons ban on the books. You've got magazine bans on the books. You've got a one-gun-a-month law that's on the books. I mean, you've got very restrictive gun control law. Oh, you may issue concealed carry laws in Maryland. You have very restrictive gun control laws on the books there that haven't done anything to reduce violent crime. Again, Baltimore looking at a third year in a row of more than 300 homicides, looking at perhaps an all-time high in terms of the per capita homicide rate in Baltimore. But what we're seeing here, I think, again, around the country, whether it's the Kansas City Star, the Portland Tribune, or other papers, an attempt to sort of cherry-pick the data, right? Let's just take a look at this particular year and that particular year, and we'll look at this particular crime, and we'll try to make the case, again, that these gun control laws are working, as opposed to actually looking at what has taken place around the country, what took place in these particular states before these gun control laws were put on the books, and what's happened after that reporting period. Like, again, if you want to look at, let's say, 1994 to 2008, why stop there? Why stop with 2008? What happened in 2009? What happened in 2010? A lot of times, the reason why they'll stop the gathering of those statistics and the data on a particular year is because if you include additional years, all of a sudden their hypothesis falls apart. It doesn't hold a lot of water. Now, again, for 25 years in this country, we saw violent crime drop dramatically. It was going in the right direction. And what was the federal gun control law that resulted in that drop? And why, if gun control laws are responsible for the reduction in violent crime in places like Oregon or Connecticut, why are we seeing violent crime go up in other states that have passed these restrictive gun control laws? We are, without a doubt, seeing a huge push within the media to try to convince Americans, A, that gun control laws are popular, B, gun control laws are effective. And they really, again, are using some piecemeal, cherry-picked data points to try to make that case. I'm sure before long we'll actually see somebody talk about how great it is that, Washington State, Colorado, have these quote-unquote universal background check laws on the books, even though gun control advocates like Garen Wintemute have acknowledged, okay, having these laws on the books haven't actually led to increased background checks in these states. It was 2 weeks ago, the big hue and cry from the media was, when do we get to have a conversation about gun control? We're having it. But it'd be nice to have a real conversation. Right? Like an actual honest-to-goodness conversation about, okay, well, what's going on here in these places where you've put the gun control laws on the books and it really hasn't worked out the way that you hoped for? And what happened in the United States when violent crime was dropping for more than two decades without any new federal gun control laws on the books? Again, we all want to see, regardless of whether or not we're gun owners, regardless of how we feel about the Second Amendment, if you're an American who's not out there committing violent crimes, I'm pretty sure you want to see this country become a safer place. That's not the dispute. That's not the fracture point between Americans. The disagreement is, well, how do we get there? And for anti-gun activists, the answer is, well, we get there by having fewer guns. More guns equals more crime. For a lot of gun owners, again, you look at the more than 50% reduction of violent crime in this country while gun ownership is increasing, while there were millions of Americans becoming concealed carry holders. You know, the basic foundational premise of the gun control movement is more guns equals more crime. That was not the reality and has not been the reality in the United States for 25 years. More guns and less crime. So when do we actually get to have that real conversation instead of just the competing bumper sticker slogans? When we come back after a quick break, we'll have a real conversation with Tim Lee from the Center for Individual Freedom. Also, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins from Breitbart joining us here in a few minutes. So stick around. There is much more Cam and Company still to come.
Speaking with Morgan Shields with the NRA Office of General Counsel. Morgan, welcome to the program. I'm excited to talk about the Civil Rights Defense Fund Youth Essay Contest. You guys do a lot of great work over there in the Civil Rights Defense Fund and the Office of General Counsel. I love what you do. So when I saw the opportunity to talk about this, I wanted to schedule an interview to talk about this. So tell us, what is a Youth Essay Contest?
So the Youth Essay Contest is something the Civil Rights Defense Fund hosts every year, and it's for students from 12th grade to younger, and it gives students the opportunity to really reflect and think about how the Second Amendment affects them and what they think about the Second Amendment.
And why did you guys figure that it was important to do this?
Right, so part of the Civil Rights Defense Fund's mission is to promote education and scholarship on the Second Amendment. And part of the way we do that is by getting students and young adults to start thinking about that and producing these essays and give them the chance to enter this contest.
That's a great idea to get them thinking at that age about the Second Amendment. And who can qualify for this? What are the age ranges in the grades?
So there's two categories. There's a senior category, which is basically high school students, so 9th grade to 12th grade. And then there's a junior category, which is 8th grade and younger. So if you can write an essay, you can enter.
And when is the deadline for this, Morgan?
The deadline is December 31st. It used to be December 1st, but we've extended the deadline to December 31st to give students the opportunity over Christmas break when they're not in school to sit down and enter the contest.
Great idea. Morgan Shields, Office of General Counsel, the Civil Rights Defense Fund Youth Essay Contest. How do we get more information?
So you can go to the CRDF's website, which is nradefensefund.org, or you can call the Office of General Counsel at 703-267-1250.
Last summer, five Dallas law enforcement officers were killed while protecting hundreds of protesters who marched against America's police. My brother, Mike Kroll, was one of them. No protesters lost their lives. No media were hit by bullets. But Mike was there, protecting, serving, sacrificing, as he did every day for 8 years on the Dallas PD. The National Rifle Association honors such sacrifice. While the media paints our police as criminals and celebrities attack them, the NRA backs our blue. Now you can too. Donate your vehicles to NRA Cars for Freedom. Visit NRACarsForFreedom.com or call 1-866-NRA-GIFT. Donations are tax deductible and will help provide training for law enforcement. My brother gave his life protecting those who marched against him. That's why I back our blue. Stand with me. NRACarsForFreedom.com. 1-866-NRA-GIFT.
You know him? My mission in life is to set a new standard by educating, training, and equipping my fellow warriors and citizens to become assets to themselves, their families, and this country. This mindset has led me on a path to become a self-protection expert, and I'm excited to share some of my knowledge with you guys. On this season of Noir, I'll be showcasing some of the best in self-defense, and I'll be showing my techniques in super slow motion. Over the next few months, NRA TV will be releasing a constant stream of interviews, scenarios, and techniques in slow motion. Get ready, guys, because this is going to be a whole new way for you to engage and become an asset.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins with Breitbart later in the hour. About an hour from now, Kurt Schlichter from Town Hall joins us. And right now, I want to welcome to the program from the Center for Individual Freedom, Mr. Tim Lee is with us. Tim, how are you, sir?
Hey, good. How about you? You know, it's rivalry week, so my stomach's a ball of knots. But at least USC already cleared UCLA, so that pestilence is taken care of. But got a few more, and I know you guys... Trying to remember whom Oklahoma State plays this week.
You know, listen, after the K-State game, I couldn't even tell you, honestly. I'll be able to know by Saturday who they're playing. But what is it? I guess actually it's Kansas. So there you go. We should didn't get it done against Kansas State. Hopefully we'll be able to get it done against the Jayhawks.
I was about to say, you know, at least you're not Kansas. And there's no shame in losing to Kansas State. It's a good program. Bill Snyder's a fantastic coach.
Yeah, but, you know, we should have won. That was in Stillwater. That was a game you should have won. But, you know, it's the way the ball bounces. It's been a year of a couple of disappointments for Oklahoma State. Now, I want to talk about your latest column at CFIF.org. We were talking a little bit about this same issue with Andrew Langer last hour. The FCC and quote-unquote net neutrality, you write, among the many positive changes within the federal government since the end of the Obama administration and the arrival of the Trump administration, perhaps none surpass those brought by the Federal Communications Commission under new chairman Ajit Pai. So you say that the most welcome and beneficial change is its action to rescind the Obama FCC decisions to begin regulating the Internet as a quote-unquote public utility. You say that action instantly began to stifle new broadband investment, was subject to legal reversal, and is now it looks like we're going to get that reversal. So let me ask you this, Tim. Who are those objecting to what the FCC is getting ready to do? Who are the big players who don't like this?
Well, people who reflexively take the opposite position of any conservative or libertarian or, in this day and age, Donald Trump. More generally, the left, and more specifically, at least in the crony capitalist terms and industry terms, are the content providers. And if that term isn't familiar, a content provider is somebody like YouTube or Netflix or Facebook, all of which I love, that put content onto the internet, as opposed to the internet service providers who build the pipes, essentially, through which all that content goes. And so what the content companies want is a free ride. YouTube wants to just, you know, flood the internet highways and the internet infrastructure with its content. And that's all well and good, but then they want to go to Washington and have a business model that suits them and punishes internet service providers imposed by Washington. And that's just not fair, and it's not right. And as I point out in that article, just looking at the numbers in terms of private investment and broadband investment, it's harmful. And so what has to happen is we need to go back to the regulatory regime that stood for 20 years. That covered both Democratic and Republican administrations. So anybody who's sort of clueless about this, just stop and ask yourself. Over the last 20 years, the internet has flourished like no innovation and no invention in human history. Why was that? It's because beginning with the Clinton-Gore administration and then continuing through the Bush administration, the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, took a light-touch regulatory approach. They sort of let the Internet grow. They didn't impose a one-size-fits-all business model on it, and they certainly didn't tip the scales in favor of one set of companies versus another. Well, along comes the Obama administration, and years of this pent-up leftist agenda settling came through. And so that FCC upended 20 years' worth of regulatory light-touch regulation, and they started regulating the Internet as a public utility. Now, that's not my word for it. I'm not slurring it. They actually used the term public utility. What they did is they said, instead of an information service, which the Clinton administration and the Bush administration FCCs had classified the Internet as, they wanted to redefine it as a telecommunications service under 1930s laws imposed for copper wire telephones. And so that was their way to shoehorn Internet service into this vast regulatory agenda of the Obama administration. It only happened in 2015. So whenever you hear these so-called net neutrality activists say that, you know, somehow the Trump administration is upsetting the apple cart, it was actually the Obama administration that upset the apple cart and overturned 20 years worth of bipartisan FCC regulation. And so in very, very bumper sticker terms, what's happening is the Obama administration tried to regulate the Internet like a public utility. The Trump administration is going back to the light touch regulation that served for 20 years over Clinton and Bush administrations and allowed the Internet to become what it was. And so that's essentially what's going on here. Unfortunately, those on the left and those who favor more federal regulation of the Internet, I mean, people out there are probably thinking, yeah, just what the Internet needs is more federal regulation. You know, that's getting reversed, and it's a very, very good thing. But unfortunately, the left has tried to capitalize on the term net neutrality and say that Internet service providers are now free to block websites. Ask yourself this. What Internet service provider would stay in business if they started blocking legal websites? It wouldn't happen because people would say, oh, I'm not giving them my business. I want to access these sites, and I'm sick of this Internet service provider blocking it. So that's all just nonsense, and it's unfortunate nonsense, and unfortunate in the sense that it's kind of gained popular currency, but it's just not the case. What the Trump FCC under new chairman Ajit Pai is doing is phenomenal, and everybody out there should welcome it.
All right, so when do you think, I guess maybe the better question is, what will the big changes be for consumers, for users of the Internet? Will there be noticeable changes?
On an everyday basis, probably not, because the Obama upending of the apple cart that I talked about just a couple of years ago, you know, it's impacted private investment, but fortunately it's only about a year old. And so at this point, I think people will, you know, you won't notice a night and day difference. The problem is if the Trump FCC under Ajit Pai had not reversed the Obama administration heavy-handed regulation, you would have seen this gradual decline because private companies are less willing to invest in building out network and modernizing network if they're just going to get kneecapped by the federal government. Here's an analogy that sometimes I use that I think helps for people who don't understand sort of this tech policy issue and Title II regulation. Imagine you own a moving company. You move people's homes from one place to another. And the federal government comes in and says, you cannot charge or prioritize, you know, a hospital or a studio apartment. You have to charge them the same rate as a 10-bedroom mansion. You know, I think that intrinsically strikes most people as absurd and unfair, and that's essentially what was going on with Title II regulation. They were telling these Internet service providers, you have to treat, you know, Netflix and YouTube that are just overwhelming the Internet infrastructure the same way as critical medical information that needs to get to the hospital instantly. And so that's essentially what's going on, and that's sometimes, I think, an analogy that helps.
Okay. Tim Lee, again, with the Center for Individual Freedom. I appreciate you coming on the program here. One last question for you. Favorite Thanksgiving side dish? What are you looking forward to here on Thursday?
In-N-Out Burger. my mom used to make this broccoli cheese casserole. That's probably different than most of what your other guests are saying, so I guess I'll go with that one.
Okay. Actually, you're the first person I've asked that question to, so there you go. You've taken broccoli cheese casserole.
Turkey, which,
Well, no, I said side dish. You can't pick turkey. Everyone's going to go with turkey. That's why I specifically said side dish. But
gotcha.
Listen, a good broccoli cheese casserole, that's a good pick. You didn't say green bean casserole, so you got. I'll give you a thumbs up.
Just don't kill any pigs this week, please.
Okay, stay away from my Instagram and Twitter feed on Sunday, okay?
All right. Have a good Thanksgiving, Kim.
All right, you too, Tim. Tim Lee joins from the Center for Individual Freedom. Yeah, if you if you're upset about where bacon comes from, you don't like to think about that. You just like to think about the finished product. Yeah, stay away from my social media this weekend, because we have three that were born earlier this year that are now good size. And, you know, honestly, like, we probably would have put it off, but. And you've heard me complain about this over the course of the year. So, like, these pigs that were born in the spring, I don't know what it is about these pigs. It's the first time we've ever had trouble. We have ElectroNet. So it's like a portable electric fence that we set up for the hogs. We can move them around, and they get fresh pasture, and it's never been an issue. Never had a problem with the pigs staying in the electric fence until this year. And when the little bacon seeds were little, they were scooting out from under. They were squeezing through the holes in the fence. So we said, okay, this is just getting ridiculous. So we switched out the pig netting for poultry netting, smaller squares of the electric fence so they can't, you know, squeeze through. And now they're too big to squeeze through anyway. But I guess they're just putting up with the zapping that they get because they're squeezing under the fence now. They're rooting around, and they're squeezing under the fence. The other day, I go to walk the dogs, and my year-old huge hound dog Booker takes off without a leash, and then the puppy Zelda takes off after him. They're chasing the goats that I've let roam because the garden is now dead, so they can, you know, have at it and eat all the leaves that they want. So I've got two dogs chasing six goats around. Me chasing the two dogs, which are chasing the six goats. I finally get the two dogs cornered where the goats area normally is. And as soon as I show up there, I see two pigs hanging out where the goats are supposed to be. So I had six goats, two dogs, two pigs that weren't supposed to be there. My wife, by the way, is at her woodworking class, so I'm dealing with this by myself. Thankfully, my youngest son came out, and we helped to get everybody wrangled up. But this has been an ongoing issue, and now that the pigs are big enough and the freezer is mostly empty, Saturday the high is supposed to be 61, so it's going to be a little too warm. Sunday the high is supposed to be 45. So Sunday morning, we've got a friend coming over, and if learning where bacon comes from makes you sad, I'm not going to post, you know, anything that's, you know, absolutely going to be terrifying or triggering to anybody. But, yeah, there probably will be some pig processing pictures and tweets at some point this weekend. All right. Still to come on the program, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins from Breitbart will join us on the show. And, you know, we were just talking a little bit ago about Brandeis University, the armed robbery that was there, and the play about free speech on campus that got shut down. We talked with the folks from the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education about that a couple of weeks ago. And over at thefire.org, Kelsey Naughton has a piece. It's the fourth installment in a series that the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education has been doing called Speaking Freely. And they are looking at college students' attitudes towards expression and freedom of expression on college campuses. And this is a really interesting post that Kelsey Naughton put up yesterday, looking at the differences between two-year and four-year college students in terms of how much they support freedom of expression on campus. So they did a pretty big study, looked at, I think, over 1,000 different students, 1,250 students at American colleges and universities. About 33% of those respondents were community college students. And what they said, students in according to the FIRE, students at 2- and 4-year colleges report similar attitudes when asked if they are comfortable sharing ideas and opinions in the classroom and on campus outside of the classroom. 87% of students said they felt comfortable sharing ideas and opinions in their college classrooms. That'd be 85% of 2-year students, 88% of 4-year students. So really not that much different. Slightly larger differences, though, between the attitudes of 2-year students and 4-year students when students were asked about protest and intolerant and offensive ideas. So when it came to the 2-year students, the community college students, 66%, two-thirds of the students that were surveyed, strongly agreed or agreed that it is, quote, important to be part of a campus community where they are not exposed to intolerant and offensive ideas. Two-thirds of community college students said it's important to be part of a campus community where they are not exposed to intolerant or offensive ideas. 55% of 4-year students said the same thing. 46% of community college students or 2-year students agreed that they should not have to walk past student protests on their college campuses. 37% of 4-year students agreed. So what's kind of interesting is that, you know, we are talking a lot about and we hear a lot about these protests on 4-year institutions, right? Evergreen State College, UC Berkeley, Brandeis University. But this research from the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education suggests that intolerance towards freedom of expression and tolerance of differing ideas is actually in greater danger on community college campuses, on campuses of 2-year institutions, that you actually will find students who are less agreeable to the idea of interacting with people that they disagree with. And I don't think that's really been talked about. I mean, you get the, I certainly get the sense that this is all coming from, you know, Ivy League institutions, from $60,000 a year colleges like, you know, Reed College in Portland, Oregon. And what the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education suggests is that we need to be looking at our local community college systems, too, because we might be shocked at the intolerance towards freedom of expression that we would find there. All right. When we come back here on Cam and Company, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins at Breitbart, kicking around some of the big Second Amendment stories, including the 21 different gun controls currently being pushed by anti-gun lawmakers in the Senate. Stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company right after this.
Speaking with Adam Burt with JP Rifles. Tell folks, first of all, Adam, what is JP Rifles?
So JP Rifles essentially is a rifle manufacturer and component builder for AR-15, AR-10, or MSR series of rifles. We represent the really high end of the market, sort of the Ferrari of the AR and AR component segment of the market.
So when we talk about, you guys produce everything from the rifle itself to the components. Just walk us through that a little bit. We understand what a rifle is, but what are some of the components for these AR rifles that you guys do?
Sure. We make everything literally from the muzzle through the receivers and the triggers. You know, we're known for world-class match-grade accuracy barrels, things of that nature. Our heritage lies in coming out with some market-disrupting technologies. We were the first market with an adjustable gas block well over a decade ago, a low-mass operating system, very, very precise single-stage triggers. So that's where we've got our lineage and heritage. And I've got a couple specific products to show you today if you'd like.
I'd love to. Speaking with Adam Burt with JP Rifles, he's the general manager there. Tell us about the JP PSC-11, Adam.
Sure. So the rifle I've got in front of me is chambered in Federal's new 224 Valkyrie. And this, we've been involved in testing for several months now with our friends and neighbors over at Federal. This represents a new paradigm in AR cartridges. This is a 1,300-yard capable cartridge out of a small-frame AR-15-sized rifle.
Wow.
So you're getting about 85% of the horsepower of a 6.5 Creedmoor, yet it's in a small frame AR-15, you know, lightweight, small package.
That's got to be getting quite a reaction in the industry.
I'm actually very surprised and happy with the reaction it's had. I've been involved with it here for a few months. Personally, I shot it at a match some 3 weeks ago up against guys with 6.5 Creedmoors and 6mm, you know, yada yada dashers and 6 Creedmoors and stuff like that. I never felt undergunned. It was a pleasure to walk around with a lightweight rifle and go toe-to-toe with guys shooting typical 6.5 Creedmoor class cartridges.
And I'll tell you what, Adam, what we love here at NRA News and NRA TV is to talk about the innovations. It's great to see folks like you out there at JP Rifles who are out there innovating and, you know, getting this stuff done. Tell us a little bit more about this rifle.
Yep, so the rifle itself is a 20-inch PSC 11, so it's got both the typical top charge operating system, but if I flip around, it's got a side charge system as well. So the benefit there is as you're shooting it, in order to clear malfunction, charge the rifle, whatever you may need to do, you can do that without relinquishing your cheek weld. So it represents our typical accuracy. It's got a 20-inch medium contour barrel, thermal dissipator to minimize thermal drift, all the accuracy, precision you'd expect from a JP rifle.
All right, let's move on to the variable mass bolt carrier system.
Yeah, so this is our response to everybody and kind of the suppressor craze. So by putting a suppressor on a rifle, it injects a little bit of adversity naturally with increased port pressure, back pressure, lots of fouling from shooting suppressed. So we've come to market with a bolt carrier system that has a buffering mass in the tailstock of the carrier. What that does is essentially double your dead blow hammer effect. It allows the carrier group to chug through all the fouling filth that comes from shooting suppressed. It also adds a little bit of additional mass to help regulate the bolt velocity. So when you increase the port pressure, you can tune that one of two ways through adjusting your gas system or increasing or changing the mass, the reciprocating mass. And this allows you to do that with a buffering component. So these are little masses here. They slide much like the insides of a dead blow hammer or a legacy style buffering system in the back of the rifle. It increases the reliability substantially and allows you to put a suppressor on your rifle, not change a thing, and run it through just about any amount of fouling.
How do we get more information about JP Rifles?
Yeah, visit our website, jprifles.com. We're on Facebook and Instagram. Give us a call. Shoot us an email. Happy to help you out.
Adam, thanks so much for what you do. Thanks for being on the program. Welcome back to Cam and Company, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. Top of the hour, we have our hero of the day, also deal of the day, and our good guys as well. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from Breitbart News, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins is with us. Dr. Hawkins, how are you, sir?
I'm doing good, doing good. You know, I don't want you to feel like I hold grudges, but I've been thinking for months that I was going to hear Carry On, Wayward Son. We've been talking about that. But then you played Molly Hatchet for bumper music, and we're square for life right now. I just want you to know you and
okay, that's good.
Are square for life.
All right, I'm glad to hear that because you know I'm typically not in control of the music that you hear. That would be the other Cam that you have to talk to about that. So if you don't hold a grudge against Cameron Gray either. I'm glad to know that you all are squared away and good to go. And, I'll put it down as my New Year's resolution. We'll play Carry On Wayward Son for you at some point in 2018, okay?
You just played Molly Hatchet. I mean, it's over. It's just one of those moments. It's one of those moments we're never going to supersede, but we're never going to transcend the level of exuberance I feel at this moment right here. Never going to happen.
All right. Well, there you go. You heard it, Cameron. And we've already just nailed it. So from here on out, it's like Air Supply, Christopher Cross,
ABBA, whatever you
ABBA.
Find.
Yeah. Okay, there you go. Chuck Mangione, maybe. Ed Breitbart, you have a story at Breitbart right now on the 21 gun control salute that Democrats have put forth in the Senate. 21 gun control ideas, all again aimed at law-abiding legal gun owners, not at, these are not laws or bills that are aimed at
violent criminals. These are bills that are aimed at restricting the right to keep and bear arms.
That's it, plain and simple. And, you know, when I wrote that, I'm going to be honest with you, Cam, when I wrote it, I thought people are going to think I'm making it up if they only read the title. But if you get in there, as you know, it's all documented. There are 21 honest gun controls, all different, that they're pushing right now. Some of them as silly as new regulations for single fire rifles. No, you know, forever the left has told us the Second Amendment protects muzzle loaders, not semi-automatics. Now what are they doing? Now they want new regulations on muzzle loaders. I mean, you know, we know that they were wrong in that interpretation, but I'm just saying they've used every excuse they could along the way, and now they're going after everything, semi-automatics, all-out gun bans, single-shot rifles, bump stocks, just shoulder and arm braces to help you hold a certain gun still, tracer ammo, on and on. It's crazy.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, this is all done, couched in the phraseology of, you know, common sense gun safety measures, right? They're not calling it gun control. They're still claiming this is all about public safety. This is all going to lead to a safer society. But as you say, I mean, you know, when you're going after muzzle loaders, right? When all of a sudden now, you know, single shot rifles are these modern battlefield weapons of war. Magazines, you know, magazine bans. So you have a magazine that's over 10 rounds. All of a sudden, you shouldn't be allowed to own that anymore. I mean, we've seen, you know, what's amazing is that you're actually seeing bills offered in Congress that sort of mirror a lot of anti-gun legislation in places like California, New York, legislation that has been challenged and in some cases actually stopped by the federal court system. It's still full speed ahead on Capitol Hill for these gun control advocates.
Right, right. I think what you're saying is very important for people to understand. That legislation in states like California has been challenged on a philosophical basis that it is in contradiction with the Second Amendment. And on that basis has been stopped. You know, the high capacity quote unquote high capacity magazine ban was stopped. That's not the only one, but that's an example. That's on a philosophical basis. But on a practical basis, this is even more important to me. It's failing. On a practical basis, April 18th this year, we had an attack in Fresno, California. December 2nd, 2015, had an attack in Fresno, California, in San Bernardino, California, where 14 people were killed. And I could keep listing those. I don't want to take up all our time. My point is, it's philosophically against the Second Amendment, and practically, it doesn't work, because all it does is it puts a law-abiding citizen in a weaker position. The criminal's still going to have his gun. He's going to have a gun of any capacity he wants. The law-abiding citizen's at a disadvantage.
Talking again with Dr. Edward Hawkins of Breitbart, now you also write about a couple of gun controls that are being pushed by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, who, you know, when she was in Congress, when she was in the House of Representatives, a pro-gun representative. Then she took Hillary Clinton's Senate seat in New York, and lo and behold, almost overnight, her attitude towards firearms changed. So she's pushing two bills. You say the first of the two is a federal ban on firearms trafficking, even though that trafficking is already clearly prohibited via ATF background check form 4473. She's also pushing a piece of legislation called the Hedea Pendleton and Nyasa Pierre Yard Gun Trafficking and Crime Prevention Act, which would, quote, make it illegal to sell, purchase, or transfer two or more firearms to someone whom the seller knows or has reasonable cause to know is a felon or a convicted domestic abuser. That, to me, Dr. Hawkins, sounds like that also mirrors existing federal law, which would prohibit the purchase or transfer of one firearm to someone who you know or has reasonable cause to know is a prohibited person.
See, that's the whole part that bothers me. Well, it's not the whole part, but what do you mean? You have to do it twice before it's illegal? I mean, common sense tells me I'm not passing a gun to a felon, period. Why is it not illegal until we do it twice in her world? That's what I want to know. I didn't write this. I wrote this and I erased it because I didn't want to make an assumption. But I'll give you my opinion. This is part of what's indicative about Democrats' approach to gun laws. They don't really want to stamp out violence. they would rather have a continued low amount of violence because that continues to give them momentum to push more gun control. And that was my first thought when I read the way she had worded that.
You also say that the 21st gun control currently being pushed is a regulation on the so-called ghost guns, firearms that are assembled at home by hobbyists, generally speaking. You say the establishment media currently pointing to two crimes committed with the quote-unquote ghost guns as justification for a new federal law to regulate the sale and manufacture, not of these firearms, because again, they're not firearms, but to regulate, I guess, what, the sale and manufacture of firearm accessories. I mean, do they want to get to a point where we're not allowed to work on our own guns anymore?
Right. Well, I think that would be the natural outgrowth, Cam, because they present this as you order a kit, it comes in the mail, boom, you put it together, you have a firearm. No, you have to have quite a bit of know-how. You have to have familiarity not only with the firearm, but with the equipment necessary to work on it. You have to pay for that equipment. You know, there are some mills you could have at home that help you do these kind of things. You're going to pay $1,700 plus for them, $1,700 plus. Why would a criminal do that when he could just go down on the corner, lay down $75 and get his semi-automatic 22 or 38 or whatever he's buying on the black market? This is just another push to creep further into the home of law-abiding citizens and take away what little smell of liberty they still enjoy. That's all this is.
Talking again with Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart. You also noted in that story, Dr. Hawkins, that it was just last month that Chuck Schumer, was kind of warning his colleagues here, hey, you know, lay low. Let's not push this stuff right now. Let's wait until after the midterms. Maybe we'll take back the Senate. We'll take back the House. And then we can really start to push it. But don't scare the voters away. You say that right now his colleagues don't really seem to be listening. I would agree with you. And I, you know, we were talking last hour with Scott Bach, who's the executive director of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs. And we were talking about the elections in New Jersey and in Virginia, where anti-gun advocates unfortunately made big gains. I'll be honest with you, Dr. Hawkins, I don't see anti-gun activists in New Jersey or Virginia laying low between now and the midterms either. I think they're going to come in next year. They're going to be pushing hard for these gun control laws. And frankly, you know, it's up to people like you and I to make sure that gun owners know what's going on. But it's also, gun owners around the country have got to inform their fellow gun owners about the threats that are coming, because we cannot afford apathy. We cannot afford ignorance right now, or we're going to see our rights diminished.
Oh, you're 100% correct. We can't. I trust Trump on the Second Amendment, but we can't rest in Trump. And I mean it this way, to your point, there has to be activism at every level. I need to be calling my personal U.S. rep, my personal senators. I need to be calling them, emailing them, writing them, letting them know, hey, no, there is no wiggle room on the Second Amendment. At the same time, the good news is what Schumer warned about. You'll remember everybody said we had a Trump slump after Trump was elected. The threat of gun control's gone. Gun sales have gone down. That was never fully true, but I can see ways people see that. Well, what the Democrats are going to do, they're going to give people another reason to flood those gun stores, to flood those gun shows, and it's going to build up that's not straw man, but it's going to give them something they can vote against November 2018. And Schumer knows it. He already sees the writing on the wall. So we have to be active. We have to stop them. At the same time, if they keep running their mouths, they are going to give a lot of people who would have otherwise been disinterested, they're going to give them a reason to vote, because they're going to vote for their guns.
Absolutely. Dr. Hawkins, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. I hope you have a very happy Thanksgiving. I will ask this question. I asked it of our previous guest. Favorite Thanksgiving side dish?
Oh, man, that's easy. Stuffing with gravy on it. Well, see, I can't. It's stuffing with gravy and mashed potatoes. It's all mixed up together. It's perfect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If I can eat that, you got to put the gravy on it.
It's going to be awesome.
There you go. And you aim into the gravy on the stuffing. Listen, yes. Dr. Hawkins, we are very thankful that we get to talk with you on a regular basis here. Hope that you and yours have a fantastic Thanksgiving, and we'll do this again soon.
Thank you, buddy. And God bless you, and I hope you do well.
Thank you, sir. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins with us from Breitbart on Twitter at AWR Hawkins. Next hour, Kurt Schlichter from Town Hall. Why do I have the feeling, Cameron, that Kurt says is going to say that his favorite Thanksgiving side dish, progressive tears? Why do I just know.
His favorite beverage, at least.
That's his gravy at the table on Thanksgiving. Just, you know, let me pour some progressive tears over the turkey. Oh, there you go. Derek Hunter, host of the Derek Hunter Show on WBAL in Baltimore, Maryland, going to join us next hour as well. And at the top of the hour, we have today's hero of the day. We have our deal of the day and our good guy. I also want to, if we have time next hour, we might have to push this off until tomorrow. But I want to talk about Jay-Z. He's got an article in the New York Times, an op-ed, talking about the prison sentence for the rapper Meek Mills. We talked about this on the program last week. The idea that Meek Mill, who recently had a 2 to 4 year prison sentence imposed for violating probation, that he is being, quote, entrapped and harassed by the criminal justice system. That's what Jay-Z says. So if that's the case, I mean, what happens when you violate your probation? Should there be any consequences for violating your probation? Because we're going to go through some other cases here that don't involve celebrities like Meek Mill, who are facing plenty of prison time for violating their probation for previous crimes. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Speaking with Christina Krawczyk with NRA Field Ops Division about the NRA Yes program, and the NRA Yes program is expanding in 2018. I'm very excited about that. Christina, welcome back, and tell folks, what is the NRA Yes program?
The NRA Youth Education Summit is a one-week educational fellowship with a little bit of competition attached to it. Basically, the whole mission is for us to bring these students here to headquarters and spend a week with them so that they can become active citizens at both national and local levels. What does that mean? We bring them here for a week. They come to headquarters. They learn about NRA programs. We take them over to the range to shoot. We take them into Washington, D.C. We tour the monuments. We go to a lot of different museums. They have debates that they've been working on their debate groups for a month prior to this. We have people from different departments that are judging. We're watching them as they emerge. Some of them come here very shy. They emerge as these incredible leaders. So at the end of the week, we're doling out about $20,000 in college scholarships. So what we're looking for are it's an incredible group of patriotic, bright students from across the country. We pick about 40 to 50 students every year. And we're looking for those who are highly involved in academics and leadership and community service. So you are getting quite a caliber of leaders, which is what we need, don't we?
Absolutely. So are these high schoolers going into college or already in college that's going after this college money?
These are upcoming juniors and seniors. Okay. So right now, applications are open. And what's exciting is what you said, we're going to have 2 weeks. Now, this isn't 2 weeks for one group. We're having two separate sessions
So in the past, so folks know, there was always the YES program. They came here for 1 week. So this is big.
Right.
This is big. Now you guys are going to two different programs.
Yes. And it's wonderful because these kids are involved in so many different things that a lot of times they're unable to apply because they have different competitions that are coming up. And again, school's a lot different than what it was when we were going to school. There's a lot of schools that are year round. And so this gives them another opportunity to come for a different week. And again, like I said, it is in July. It's July 9th through the 15th and July 23rd through the 29th. So when they apply, they can check mark which week is better for them or if either week works for them. But those submissions need to be in the mail by midnight, postmarked by midnight, January 12th. We get hundreds of them. A lot of times it comes down to their personal statement. So it is really an involved application.
All right. So it's Friday, January 12th, midnight. Must have your application postmarked. And now the two sessions are July 9th through the 15th and 23rd through the 29th. A big thing
Correct.
For the YES program expanding in 2018. I love it. I love it. So what's a good way for folks to learn more about this?
Ways that they can find out more about YES is to head over to our website. That's yes.nra.org. Everything you need is right there, including state YES. There are state YESs for a couple of different states. We have it in Alaska, Oregon, Texas, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and West Virginia. So there's a couple of different ways that these folks can get involved in YES. But again, they don't want to waste any time. We want to get those applications in, and we are so looking forward to seeing them in 2018.
Christina Krawczyk, NRA Field Ops Division, the YES program expanding in 2018. Thank you so much for what you do. A great program here, and thanks for being on this program to talk about it.
Thank you.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company starts right now here on NRA TV. Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. On the program this hour, Kurt Schlichter from Town Hall will join us. Derek Hunter, host of the Derek Hunter Show in Baltimore, Maryland. On the Wall Street Journal story, every time you walk out the door, your life is in jeopardy. After an especially violent year in Baltimore, residents try to fight back. You know, they're trying. There are all kinds of grassroots efforts there. You had the murder-free weekends that have been held throughout the year. None of them have actually been murder-free, unfortunately. But residents are fed up, and they are speaking out. About the dysfunctional city government and the lack of progress. I mean, again, the city's going the wrong direction when it comes to violent crime. But we'll talk about that with Derek Hunter a little bit later on in the hour. Right now, let's get to today's hero of the day, our deal of the day, our good guy of the day. And our hero of the day brought to you by AdCorps Defense from WHIO Channel 7 in Dayton, Ohio. A 22-year-old Dayton business owner fired a rifle at burglars breaking into his cell phone store early Sunday morning. Dayton police dispatched to the Fix or Sell Now store around 5 a.m. After the business owner called to report the attempted robbery Sunday morning. According to a police report, owner Adam Seaton was several blocks away when he got a notification on his phone from the store's security system. As he pulled up to the store, he told Dayton police he saw two men running from his business. Seaton said one of the men stopped, pulled out a gun, and pointed it in his direction. According to police, Seaton then grabbed a rifle from his passenger seat and fired at the man. Seaton told Channel 7 he believes that one of the suspects was hit, but he said he couldn't be sure. He said typically robberies at the store are done in 20 to 45 minutes. He said, but I happen to be in the right place at the right time. He told police that the would-be thieves wearing black masks fled on foot after he fired shots. He said he actually followed the two guys in his truck as they made their way into a running getaway truck. He then continued to follow the suspects after they drove away. He says that's when they began firing at him out of a driver's side window. Seaton said he backed off, ending his pursuit, then going back to the store, alerting police. He told WHIO, he said, listen, we've got to give these guys punishment. He said they're just stealing stuff, and the courts just let him out the next day. He says it's not the police. It's the justice system. The police arrest them, and the courts just let them out the next day. And this 22-year-old, he's 22 years old, and he owns his own business. That's pretty awesome. He said since he opened the store in December of last year, so it's been open almost a year, he says he has been robbed four times, like one a quarter. He's been robbed. He says this is the first that he has successfully stopped. As for what other business owners can do to prevent robberies, Seaton advised that they purchase a folding security gate. He said, just had my security gate save my inventory from getting stolen, so invest in one of those. According to the report, officers reviewed store surveillance, which showed one suspect threw a brick through a security gate reinforced window, another standing watch outside of the store. Glad that this business owner was able to at least somewhat identify these suspects and was able to fight back after he arrived and they pointed a gun at him. Right now, again, police looking at this as a robbery and a case of self-defense by the business owner. We will try to keep our eyes on this story if there is any additional information about the robbery of the Fix or Sell store in Dayton, Ohio, or the store owner, Adam Seaton. We will let you know, but he is today's hero of the day. Our deal of the day. So I've got two for you. The first one from Fox 17 in Nashville, Tennessee. Hickman County. Terry Williams Adcock is a wife and a mom. And it was last year, actually maybe it was just a few months ago, maybe it was back in June of this year. She got a call that her husband and her three daughters had been in a car accident. She said, those 4 minutes just trying to get down the road, I didn't know what I was going to pull up on. Well, she pulled up on a crash in front of the Dollar General store there in Hickman County. Her family had been hit by a woman driving a car who was going between 72 and 76 miles an hour, passing cars in a no-passing zone, according to troopers. The woman driving the car was a woman named Sharla Bush. And according to Fox 17 in Nashville, she told police that she was behind the wheel after she'd been drinking, after she had done cocaine and taken pills. Terry Williams Adcock started videotaping the wreck scene when she got there, just force of habit. Her video showed multiple items associated with drug use found in the car. The trooper noted that there were several pill bottles, including a prescription that had been filled just 2 days earlier in the name of another woman. Terry Williams Adcock says there was one pill left in that bottle that had been filled 2 days earlier. Now, here's the thing. Sharla Bush, the driver of that car, she was already out on bond for driving without a license. She had a history of drug problems and driving problems. She's been booked on charges in Hickman, Davidson, Dixon counties. She was driving while on probation for illegal driving. And what happened? Her probation wasn't revoked. Her probation wasn't revoked. She got out on bond again. Fox 17 in Nashville says, once this case went to court, the Adcocks were ready to testify. They wanted the maximum. But Sharla Bush pleaded to lesser charges instead. And the Adcocks said they weren't even notified about that until it was over. Terry Williams Adcock says, my family was worth 4 days in jail. 4 days. That's what that woman got for driving under the influence of alcohol, pills, and cocaine while on probation for driving without a license. She's not legally allowed to drive. She was driving while impaired. She hit a car with four people inside, and she got 4 days. She got a day in jail for every person in the car that she hit as a repeat offender. Terry Williams Adcock said, since those 4 days, she said, my family was worth 4 days in jail. She said the reasons that she gave is, talking about the prosecutor, she didn't think I would want to put the children through the trial. She says, well, we didn't get to make that choice. And Fox 17 in Nashville says, since Sharla Bush got that 4 day jail sentence, she has been arrested twice more. She is still driving without a license. There is now a outstanding felony warrant for this woman, Sharla Bush. Terry Williams Adcock says, you're not immune. I'm not immune. It is a revolving door. And Terry Williams Adcock's daughter, Skyla, spoke to a Fox 17 in Nashville. Her mom says this is the first time she's talked about the accident. She was actually surprised that her daughter wanted to talk about this. She said, this has affected my whole life. She said, I can't do the things that I want to do anymore. She's getting ready to turn 16. When you turn 16, what do? You get your license. Skyla says she doesn't want her license. She doesn't want to drive. She doesn't want to be in a car. She said, after the wreck, I experienced anxiety to where I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I ended up staying late in the morning on a school night. I just don't want to drive anymore. The district attorney in this case, Kim Helper, said the sentence was in line with a DUI first offense and that it followed the spirit of the law. She says that she is planning on revoking Sharla Bush's bond And if that happens, Fox 17 International says Bush would spend 11 months in jail. Prosecutor says she's planning on revoking that bond. Now, there's already, again, a felony outstanding warrant. She's already been arrested twice since this accident. So you're planning on it. You haven't done it yet. I mean, is there any... I can completely understand why that mom and that wife, Terry Williams Adcock, is so furious about this. Because, again, here is an individual clearly can't be trusted behind the wheel of a vehicle. And yet, where is she? Out on the streets, able to get behind the wheel of a vehicle. Now, sure, she's breaking the law every time she does. But the law doesn't seem to care much about that, does it? So there in Tennessee, Sharla Bush is today's first deal of the day. Our second deal of the day from Nebraska. Norfolk 92.7, US 92, radio station there in Beatrice, Nebraska. 26-year-old woman has been sentenced by a judge there in Beatrice, Nebraska, to prison for weapon and drug charges. Morgan Kritz sentenced in Gage County District Court last Thursday to 1 year in prison for being a felon in possession of a deadly weapon. She got a consecutive 9-month prison term for possession of cocaine and possession of methamphetamine. Yeah, how about that? Drugs, weapons, convicted felon. At most, you'll do a year behind bars. That's amazing. Judge Julie Smith ordered 2 years of post-release supervision on the weapons conviction. And 9 months supervision after serving time on the drug violations. Now, here's the thing. Again, she was charged with being a felon in possession of a deadly weapon. So this was not Morgan Kritz's first time before a judge. As it turns out, this wasn't even her second time. Kritz previously sentenced to a probation term, but did not successfully complete it, according to the U.S. 92 report. She has served two prior prison terms, and the judge noted that she also has two separate criminal cases pending in Nebraska where she is charged with 5 additional felony counts. But we'll go ahead and sentence her to the bare minimum amount of time here, and she'll be back out on the streets before long. So our second deal of the day today, Morgan Kritz there in Beatrice, Nebraska. Our good guy of the day. From Manchester, New Jersey, actually Toms River, New Jersey, a Manchester Township police officer, Brian Volk, who is a 8-year veteran of the Manchester Township Force, was playing an ice hockey game last week. It was last Wednesday at Winding River Park. One of his fellow players collapsed there on the ice, according to the Manchester Police Department. Manchester police say without hesitation, Officer Volk controlled the scene, immediately began CPR. Man taken to the hospital, found to be suffering from a heart attack, but is now recovering, thanks to the quick thinking of the off-duty officer. There on the ice, off the clock, but always on the job. Brian Volk, according to the Manchester Police, said, even when off-duty, our officers are ready to assist the public when called upon. Great job, Officer Volk. So Brian Volk there. Of the Manchester Township, New Jersey Police Department, saving a life while playing hockey. He is today's good guy of the day, and we thank you for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, so still to come, we've got Mr. Kurt Schlichter joining us on the program. But I mentioned last hour, Jay-Z writing a piece of the New York Times about Meek Mills and the criminal justice system that has been stalking Meek Mills, according to Jay-Z. He said, instead of a second chance, probation ends up being a landmine with a random misstep bringing consequences greater than the crime. The person on probation can end up in jail over a technical violation like missing a curfew. Jay-Z wrote that Meek Mill's first brush with the law at 18 years of age after being convicted for drug and gun possession, served an 8-month sentence for that. He said now he's 30. He's been on probation basically his entire adult life for about a decade. He has been stalked by a system that considers the slightest infraction a justification for locking him back inside. Now, there have been repeated, again, probation violations that have not led to additional prison time for Meek Mills. This last go-round of the probation violations did lead to a judge sentencing Meek Mills to 2 to 4 years. And again, there have been, according to a WJBD radio, hundreds of protesters gathering outside of Philadelphia's Criminal Justice Center on Monday to call for his prison sentence on probation violations to be overturned. Rick Ross, Julius Erving, both showing up to speak at this event. Let Meek Mills out. He shouldn't go to prison for violating his probation. Again, you know, I'm curious about this. You know, on the one hand, again, boy, we need all kinds of new laws on the books, don't we? Got to get tough on criminals. We need all kinds of new gun control laws on the books. But you know, when somebody violates the law, and then when they violate their probation, there really shouldn't be any consequence for that. At least not going back to prison. As for the idea that Meek Mills is being stalked and harassed here. A couple of other stories around the country that haven't gotten the types of headlines that Meek Mills' case has gotten. The Sun Herald newspaper in Mississippi, Gulfport, Mississippi. Cornell Lamar Abram, 38 years of age. He was put on probation back in 2005. He was convicted of possession with intent to distribute crack in federal court, March 11th, 2005. He had also been convicted previously on the transfer and possession of a controlled substance back in 1998. So he was put on probation, had some issues. Federal judge in Gulfport had revoked his probation back in October of 2012. He got an 18-month prison term the first time his probation was revoked. July 25th. Of this year, he also had his probation revoked. He got a 3-year prison sentence for that probation violation. And in April, that last go-round that led to the 3-year sentence, as it turns out, he had 2 pistols in a vehicle, left an infant unattended while the car was parked in the emergency lane of a Family Dollar store in Birmingham, Alabama. Officers noticed the child. And so they were kind of taking an interest in this vehicle. He ran out to confront the officers. He then tried to flee and then fought police as they tried to arrest him. They found 2 pistols in his vehicle, a Smith & Wesson 9mm, a 40 caliber Glock. The Glock had been reported stolen out of Pelham, Alabama. At the time, he was wanted on a federal indictment from Gulfport, Mississippi, where he had admitted going into a couple's home with a semi-automatic pistol on June 11th, 2014. By the way, I mean, like, the only thing that happened to this guy, it sounds like, was his probation was revoked. Doesn't sound like in any of these cases a felon in possession a charge was filed within the federal court system, which could have led to a decade behind bars. So, again, does the criminal justice system stalk individuals on probation? Not in this case. They certainly didn't overcharge this guy. They undercharged him to date. Then there is the Eau Claire, Wisconsin Leader Telegram, where a county judge, John Thiessen, has ordered Scott F. Robertson to spend 4 years on extended supervision following his release from prison. He was originally sentenced in August of 2016 to 3 years of probation for 1 count of methamphetamine delivery. He violated the terms of his probation by using methamphetamine and marijuana, failing to attend appointments at the Community Transition Center, and he gets 2 years in prison now, and then will spend 4 years on extended supervision. Why? Because he just kept doing drugs after he was convicted of, you know, selling drugs. So should he have to go to prison? Again, I'm sure there'll be some folks who would say no. And then there would be others who said, well, yeah, you know, the reason why you get probation in the first case, the reason why Meek Mills, for instance, got 8 months for drug and gun charges rather than the time that he was eligible to be sentenced to, is because the criminal justice system cut Meek Mills a break and said, okay, you know what? You're going to do a little bit of time. and then we're going to let you out, even though we could keep you behind bars a lot longer. Once we let you out early from your sentence, we do expect that you will be a law-abiding individual, that you will not violate the terms of your probation. If you do violate the terms of your probation, yes, you are subject to being sentenced for the original charge. And apparently now there's just this idea that, well, that shouldn't happen. That if you get a reduced sentence and then you go on to violate the terms of your probation, nothing should really happen to you because you've already done that, that original sentence, even if it was reduced, even if the probation was a part of this sentence. When we were talking about Meek Mill's case, I think it was last week, we also told you about the sex offender in Roanoke who's going to prison for going to a street fair. I think he got 4 years for violating the terms of his probation. Then there is the Ledger Inquirer newspaper in Columbus, Georgia. John Paul Duby, Jr., on probation for 2 counts of burglary and other offenses when he tried to steal a $7,000 Rolex back on June the 3rd. He has now been sentenced. He was initially charged with robbery, pleaded guilty to felony theft by taking. Judge sentenced him to 3 years in prison and 10 years on probation, pleading guilty March 9th, 2016 to first-degree burglary, second-degree burglary, fourth-degree forgery, theft by receiving stolen property, giving police false information. That was a different case, actually. And in that case, the judge sentenced him to 10 years in prison with 2 to serve and the rest on probation. And then, amazingly enough, that was last year. This guy got a 10-year sentence, 8 of them suspended. That's going to be on probation. You serve 2 years behind bars. He didn't even do that. The Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles commuted that sentence to time served back in January of this year. So less than a year later, after being sentenced to 2 years in prison and 8 years on probation, this guy was let out, goes on to commit an additional crime, gets sentenced to, 3 years in probation, or 3 years in prison, 10 on probation. Even though the original sentence could have been reimposed on this guy. I mean, it's amazing to me that, you know, on the one hand, you have people like Jay-Z who are saying, listen, the criminal justice system is broken. It's stalking these individuals who are released from prison and they're on probation. Every time they do something wrong, they hauled back before a judge and maybe sent back to prison, and that's wrong. When you look again at the original sentence that these individuals are facing and why they get put on probation and what happens to that original sentence when they're put on probation, the time that they could spend behind prison is typically cut down dramatically. And the thought process is, okay, if we don't put you behind bars for a long period of time, we kind of scare you into recognizing the seriousness of this. When you get out, you're supposed to follow the straight and narrow. And if you don't, well, then we know that, you know, we really didn't make an impact on you. Prison didn't make an impact on you. So we'll send you back. That's how the probation system works. Sadly, it seems like in many cases, it's really not working. It's not that the justice system is stalking these probationers. It's that you're able to repeatedly violate your probation without consequence. All right, we got to take a timeout. When we come back, Kurt Schlichter joins us from Town Hall, Derek Hunter from WBAL in Baltimore later on in the program as well. So stick around. We will be back with more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Speaking with Claudia Olson with NRA Youth Programs and Education and Training. Claudia, welcome to the program. We're talking about the Outstanding Achievement Youth Award presented by Brownells. Tell us, what's it all about?
Oh, it's to award youth who have participated in the shooting sports with an award. They have core requirements that they have to fulfill. They have to be at least six. They can be no older than 21. And so there are the core requirements. They have to have taken a basic firearm class. There is those who have had that prior, and their knowledge is above that. So I do accept an instructor class or a coach class, all to encourage youth to participate more, to then also play it forward. They have to participate in the marksmanship qualification program, And there's a whole list of core requirements, five in all, that they have to do. And also then they have to have at least five of the elective requirements. And there's a whole list of different NRA programs, competitions that they have to participate in to qualify.
And why is it important that NRA do this?
Well, we have to reach out to the youth and award those who are putting forth in the shooting program and giving them an award money to use it either for school to further their shooting career or if they are planning on going to a trade school. We made it an award, not a scholarship, for the purposes that the youth can decide what to spend it on.
How do we get more information about the Outstanding Achievement Youth Award?
You can visit our website and you will be able to download the form that you need to fill out and submit with your portfolio.
Speaking with Scott Lasis, the sporting chef, we're here at a Hunt, Fish, and Feed event. Scott, tell people, what is the Hunt, Fish, and Feed program?
Hunt, Fish, Feed was started by Sportsman Channel 10 years ago. It's our response to the homeless and hungry problem in the United States. The outdoor community is a very, very generous community. As you know, I mean, we have friends that were driving their boats from Denver down to Houston during the last floods. If there's ever a catastrophic event, you can count on hunters, anglers, outdoor enthusiasts to help out. So we've got this great renewable resource. We've got venison. We have salmon. We have wild hogs. Why not use them to feed the homeless and hungry all over the United States? Homeless veterans, right? Should those two words ever be used in the same sentence? No, but we use them. You know, we're there to feed those people. And really what we wanted to do is call attention to what's going on out there and to get the hunters and anglers involved with our churches, missions, and shelters.
So how does the program work?
We get together with a group like Comcast, for instance. Comcast is very, very supportive of what we do. They always rally. Comcast will say, here's a location. Like, we're in here in Winchester, Virginia. Here's a location that we would love to participate the Hunt, Fish, Feed program with. And then they find the areas that they'll find a location, a shelter, and then we show up and we'll find venison. We have a crew of volunteers, and we show up and make a meal out of it.
How can we get more information about this program?
Go to Hunt, Fish, Feed on Facebook. Or if you go to Sportsman Channel, Hunt, Fish, Feed, it'll tell you all about it. We strongly suggest that you contact your mission, your church, et cetera, and say, how can I help?
Scott, thank you so much for what you do. Thanks for being on the program, and we're going to let you get back to work.
It's about time I did something.
All right, Scott. Hunt, Fish, Feed. Go check it out.
Got it.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Cam Edwards, your host. You can find our next guest on Twitter at Kurt Schlichter, or you can go to his law office and talk to him, but you're going to have to pay like hundreds of dollars an hour if you do that. So far better just to interact with him online or maybe listen to his appearances here on Cam and Company. Mr. Kurt Schlichter is with us. How are you, Kurt?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I'm glad to hear that. All right, so your latest column, let's all savor the Democrats' Pervgate pain. And, you know, I mean, it's hard to keep up. I mean, today, I guess you had the story about John Conyers, right, settling a lawsuit. He originally said, I have no idea that I settled this lawsuit. I don't know what you're talking about. Now, apparently, as it turns out, he was aware of this. Nancy Pelosi's calling for an ethics investigation. You still got Al Franken, who apparently won't be stepping down. Outside of the Capitol Hill area, Charlie Rose let go by PBS and CBS earlier today. Boy, oh boy. Some say it is so very wrong to take so much pleasure at a scandal in which the heroes of the Democrat Party are all being exposed as handsy, tonguey creeps. You say if it is wrong, however, to laugh at the hilarious comeuppance these hypocrites are suffering, you don't want to be right. In fact, you want to be super mega hyper wrong. So, are you engaging a little bit of a Schadenfreude over this? You
like this? I am Schadenfreuding like der Boss. That joke could have gone easily wrong into really bad, questionable territory, but it didn't.
So you say, look, sure, we have an issue of our own. You say, but is it unfair to point out that Judge Jailbait was a Democrat back when he was cruising malls for teen action? You say, yeah, probably unfair. Too bad. Own your own perversions, party of the wandering hands. And, you know, look, I mean, here's the thing. You can make the case, Kurt, that, the progressives, the Democrats, or the mainstream media, or whoever, you know, they're the ones that sort of set the agenda. And I think it's maybe the most interesting person to talk about this is, or to talk about in terms of this, is Bill Clinton. Right?
Yeah, he's a bad guy now. Did you notice all these Democrats are like, you may not have known it, but 20 years ago, Bill Clinton did X, Y, and Z. I knew it. You knew it. We all knew it.
And so, you know,
but
now,
really know
now Kirsten Gillibrand can say, oh, yeah, I think that Bill Clinton should have stepped down. Now Bill de Blasio could say, oh, yeah, I think that Bill Clinton should have stepped down. Now, you know, 20 years after the fact, it's time to get tough on people like Bill Clinton.
Now that he's no more use to them.
Right.
See, this, you know, when Roy Moore's a whole different subject, and there's lots of things to say there. But I expected next year, because I think he's probably going to get elected. I expected next year they were going to go, we were going to see a lot of ads saying, the GOP is the party of Roy Moore. And there were, now it turns out the Republicans are going to have to buy, like, much longer ads to include all the perverts that the Democrat Party is, who are the face of the Democrat Party.
You're right. If this is, you know, here's the thing. I mean, like, to me, this shouldn't be a campaign issue because you can find individuals on the left and the right. But, you know, look, I mean, you've written about this before.
It was gonna be.
Well, that's the thing. But, I mean, you've written about this in this hyper politicized world where everything is politicized. You know damn well that it's going to be a left versus right issue somehow.
Well, you know, the problem with the new rules is eventually they're going to apply to you too. And you know, there may have been a reason for the old rules, and you're going to learn it. If you decide you want to take out Republicans because of their foibles, and far be it from me to tell people what they should or shouldn't vote on, you know, if that's important to you, you should vote on it.
Mm-hmm.
But to have a blatant double standard, well, that's just not going to stand. People just aren't going to do it, and eventually it's going to come and bite you. And, you know, I think for 20 years, Bill Clinton's example was that, you know, everybody may know about me, but they're going to cover for me. And you keep hearing that and hearing that. We all knew he was like that. And suddenly the dam breaks, and now literally everybody knows it. That's why it's so hard. That's why it's so dangerous to posture as some sort of moral paragon. We are the party of women. Well, yeah, but unfortunately, it seems to be the party of groping women.
You know, and it's interesting. I mean, Michelle Goldberg at the New York Times yesterday had a piece where she talked about, you know, last week when the allegations against Al Franken came out, she said Al Franken should resign. So yesterday she writes this piece and she says, I'm still not sure I made the right call. She said, my thinking last week when the first accusation emerged was cauterize the wound. It doesn't matter that Franken's transgression wasn't on the same level as the abuses that the Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore or Donald Trump have been accused of. There you go with the politicizing, right? Photo, the unconscious woman, the leering grin, is a weight Democrats shouldn't have to carry, given that they've been lately insisting that it's disqualifying for a candidate to grab a woman sexually against her will. It seemed cruel, she writes, to expect Democratic women to make Jesuitical arguments that the shadows under Franken's hands meant he wasn't really touching Tweeden's chest, especially since with a Democratic governor in Minnesota, the party would maintain control of Franken's seat. Right. So again, well, because it's not going to impact the balance of power, yeah, Franken should go. But she writes, even as I made the case for resignation, I was relieved that it seemed as if Franken might stick around because I adore him as a public figure. It's easy, she says, to condemn morally worthless men like Trump. It's much harder to figure out what should happen to men who make valuable political and cultural contributions. Learning about all these seemingly good guys who do shameful things is what makes this moment with its frenzied pace of revelations so painful and confounding. So I do think it's interesting, Kurt, that we're now at least seeing this acknowledgement from people like Michelle Goldberg of, Well, yeah, I mean, it might have been bad, and I might have said that he should resign. But, you know, like, I like him, and I don't like Trump, and so it's different. And so, you're going to hear people on the right say, well, listen, I like Trump, but I don't like Al Franken, so, you know, whatever. I mean, as you say, the rules should apply to everybody. There shouldn't I like this person so they can skate exception.
Well, exactly. And look, it's just proof that liberalism is what I always say it was. It's a giant scam. It's a grift. It's a con. It's a pose. At the end of the day, all that matters is liberalism. And all the stuff about we love women and we love minorities and we love, you know, other kin is just baloney because it all goes by the wayside as soon as leftism gets threatened. But that's okay. I love clarifying moments because these people are revealing themselves to be exactly what they are. And if you're okay with that, that's fine. But I think that they've always made these moral appeals for a reason, which is the American people kind of tend to like morals. And, you know, when they reveal themselves as hypocrites who don't really believe a damn thing that they've been saying, I think that's going to hurt them. I think they were looking for, until about a week ago, I think they thought, oh my gosh, 2018 is going to be great. They're going to be, Republicans are going to be the party of Roy Moore. And that has all gone down the outhouse pole, whatever it is.
Yes.
I'm not an outhouse expert.
The privy. Yes.
The privy.
You're right.
The privy pit.
It's there in the lime at the bottom. I think you're absolutely right about that. And as you say, you know, this is going to 2018, I think, is, you know, I think you're going to be able to count, you know, the number of quote unquote, you know, political heroes. You won't even have to use one hand. You could probably just use like your ears. You know, I mean, like there aren't going to be a whole lot of heroes to go around because we do seem to be in the area now of uncovering years and years of gross behavior and misdeeds. And I don't know. I mean, like since you and I have been talking, Kurt, I just saw a story about John Lasseter, the head of Pixar, I guess is taking a leave of absence or stepping away for a little bit based on. Due to, quote, missteps.
You know, everything is unsettled in our society now. All the old rules have been challenged. The establishment has been challenged. The hypocrisy that we've been living under has been challenged. Our political parties don't fit the people. They're not, the establishment doesn't fit the normals. And this is just another symbol of it. Our country, before we can get back to a kind of a nice, normal, mellow vibe, I think we're going to have to decide, make some big decisions in our society. What do we stand for? What do we want? How is misbehavior by men going to be dealt with? How's misbehavior by women going to be dealt with? Because that's a bigger problem than gets a lot of play. Is an accusation going to be enough to destroy someone? You know, I mean, I'm a trial lawyer. I bring lawsuits and I defend lawsuits, and I have defended people who adamantly said I am not guilty of these horrible things that these people are talking about. And imagine yourself in that position, being accused of something horrible and being innocent. Things aren't so simple. And I think our society is going to have to work it out.
I think you're right. And I think it is going to be messy. And I think it's going to be painful. But I also think at the end of the day, we will eventually work it out.
Oh, I have nothing but confidence in the common sense of normal Americans. The elite Americans, not so much. I think that I think it's regular folks are going to have to stand up and say, okay, here's how it is. And it may look a lot like I'm not going to expect my political leaders to be paragons of virtue. Or it may be I expect a certain standard of behavior from my leaders, and you better maintain it, or the consequences are going to be your career's done. I don't know how it's going to work out.
I don't know either, but we'll be following along together. All right, we got to run, but last question, Kurt. We'll make it an easy one. Favorite Thanksgiving side dish?
Amish cream corn from central Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
Fried corn. Yep.
Amish creamed corn from central PA.
Yeah. They the Schlichter homeland. Me and Selena Zito in the house. Yes, the trial lawyer from Los Angeles. His family comes from rural Pennsylvania.
I love it. And one day we need to put together a holiday dinner with you and Selena at the same table. That would be awesome.
That would be stunning.
All right, buddy. Listen, hey, man, have a very happy Thanksgiving. Give my best to Alina and the family, and we'll talk again soon.
Okay, great.
All right, thank you, sir.
You too.
Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall with us on the program. Was not expecting the creamed corn, honestly. Was not expecting Kurt Schlichter to bring the creamed corn reference, but... you know, he always likes to surprise you. All right, when we come back, Derek Hunter, host of the Derek Hunter Show on WBAL in Baltimore, Maryland. And I'm not joking here. There are going to be a lot of people in Baltimore who are giving thanks for being alive and for giving thanks to being spared the violence in that city. And sadly, there are going to be a lot of families in Baltimore who are giving thanks for having gotten the chance to spend time with their loved ones who have been struck down by the violence in Baltimore, because they are at over 300 homicides this year. This is the third year in a row that we've seen over 300 homicides in Baltimore. Historic high levels of violence. The city doesn't seem to have any idea of what to do to get a handle on this. And the residents of Baltimore, they're fed up, but they're also, in many cases, they don't know what to do. They're not getting the help that they need from the city. They're not blaming the police. You've got people in Baltimore. I mean, think about this. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, you had riots in Baltimore over the Freddie Gray death. And people who were complaining about the Baltimore Police Department and the whole department need to be shut down. Now you've got residents of Baltimore who are saying, bring on the police state. I don't care what it means if it means less crime. I mean, that's how bad things have gotten in Baltimore, Maryland. And we're going to talk about it with Derek Hunter from WBAL right after a quick break. So stick around. There's much more Cam and Company still to come.
Speaking with Christina Krawczyk with NRA Field Ops Division. Christina, welcome back to the program. Good to have you back. Now,
always a pleasure.
I love it. I love when I get to talk to you about things like this. Coming up in November, there's a new thing, a great new phenomenon called Giving Tuesday. It's Tuesday, November 28th. But you folks over at NRA Field Ops are doing something special with Giving Tuesday. Tell us what's going on.
That's right. November 28th is Giving Tuesday. It's been around for a long time, but this is the first year that we've actually done a campaign. Now, we started the campaign October 24th, and the campaign is about stories of yes, because 100% of the proceeds are benefiting the Yes Scholarship Fund this year. So with that campaign, what we did is we took a look at some of our Yes alums. They all do phenomenal things in their community. So these are stories of giving, and we had an incredible Yes student this year that a couple of them actually that are writers. And so we had the Yes alum write stories about Yes alum on stories of giving. So those are each being posted on NRA blog each week. And it's a call to action to come donate for the cause. Now we're going to be running this campaign through the end of November 28th at midnight. And this is a friendly competition because you know that field ops are highly competitive with raising money.
No.
So, yeah, I know. It's shocking, right? So we're actually going by regions to see who can raise the most money, and that includes headquarters right here. So we are moving and grooving.
I like that.
And so far, we've been up, I guess it were about 6,000. Our goal is 10,000. Now, when you look at $10,000, you have to think about the scholarship fund, because after a week of yes, we dole out scholarship money. And this year it was almost $22,000. They were phenomenal. And the only reason we were able to do that is because one of the executives gave $5,000 out of his own pocket. So we were able to give a lot of scholarships this year. So we really hope that people read the NRA blog articles, the stories of giving about our Yes alums, and pony up, because these are our leaders of tomorrow.
So, Christina, tell us, what is the Yes program?
The Yes program is an incredible program that's been around for 21 years. It is a one-week educational fellowship. It is highly competitive to get in. So right now, applications are open, and we will close those on January 12th. What we do is we're looking for the cream of the crop. We're looking for kids that are, or students, I should say, that are highly involved in academics, leadership, and community service. They have to go through quite an application process. And then we take a look, and we've got five people going through all of those applications. And a lot of times it comes down to their essays. We pick about 40 to 45 that come here for a week to spend with us. We take them to NRA. They learn about the programs. We take them to the range to shoot. We take them into D.C. to see museums. They have discussions on topics going on in the country, as well as debates. And what we're looking for are those leaders. And we are watching them all week long. And that's how we end up giving out those scholarships on awards night. This is a life-changing week for these kids. You will hear it time and time again. It's really, it's incredible. It's incredible.
So it's Giving Tuesday, Tuesday, November 28th, but the campaign is going on now. So check it out.
It's going on right now.
Incredible and stories and stuff to see. How can we get more information, Christina?
You can go to the link. You're going to go to friendsofnra.org/Giving Tuesday, and that's going to give you a button to donate. And like I said, this is a competition, so it's going to ask you if there was anyone who suggested the donation or the Giving Tuesday. You can mark their name down. I'm happy to say Christina Krawczyk is on there. You can totally use my name.
Oh, awesome. I love that. So before we let you go, just give us in about 30 seconds, share a little bit of one of those stories. We had mentioned that before we started the interview.
I would love to. Emily Brooks, she was an alum from 2016, and it's written by Jameson Sapp, who was one of our students from 2017. And I love this beginning paragraph that Jameson writes about Emily. As an NRA Youth Education Summit alum, one thing I can state without a doubt is that every single YES participant has a passion for their country, community, and fellow citizens. Emily Brooks is a wonderful example of how that passion gets turned into action. Since attending the program in 2016, Emily has continued to give back to her community by supporting Operation Welcome Home in her home state of Illinois. The nonprofit organization works to honor veterans coming home from deployment and help support them in the transition back to civilian life.
Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Yes, the main street here in Farmville, Virginia. Already decorated for Christmas before the Thanksgiving holiday has begun. The stores will be open on Friday. If you want to come down to Farmville, Virginia, do a little holiday shopping, lots of things to see and do around here, and you won't be in Baltimore. So there's a bonus. Derek Hunter, host of the Derek Hunter Show on WBAL in Baltimore, Maryland, is with us on the program right now on Twitter at Derek A. Hunter. Derek, thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me, and it sounds lovely down there in Farmville.
It does. You and your lovely bride need to come visit at some point.
We do. I always just thought it was an app, a little game.
Right?
It turns out it's a real place.
Real place. And even better than the app, honestly, because there's like no microtransactions or anything like that, no pay to play. It's great.
Well, it's kept that app thing has kept me away from the Oregon Trail because of fear of cannibalism. So I believe everything I see in apps.
And death by dysentery. I mean, that's right. So listen, Wall Street Journal with a big story on the violence in Baltimore, Maryland. Every time you walk out the door, your life is in jeopardy. That's what one resident said. And the article in the Wall Street Journal is all about, again, these sort of grassroots efforts by residents to push back against the violence because the city seems incapable of stopping it.
The city is incapable of stopping it. Look, you know how big cities are. And Baltimore has a small town feel, and it's a smaller city mostly because of flight. People have left. I'd say white flight, but they've been gone for 30 years, and now it's anybody who can afford to leave. But they always, even cities that are crime-ridden, have their areas where they're safer. And in Baltimore, it was always a few neighborhoods, Federal Hill, Canton, and in particular the Inner Harbor, which is right near the stadiums. It's right on the water. There's restaurants and bars and museums, and the National Aquarium is there. And, Cam, we've had problems down there in the last few months. It's gotten so out of control. 10 or a gang of kids, I don't know how many kids there were, attacked a family of 10 who'd come in from Delaware to celebrate a child's birthday at the Inner Harbor and go to the aquarium and all of that. They beat them. In broad daylight. This wasn't, you know, a late night 14-year-old's birthday party. Mm-hmm. And that's the sense when the safe spaces are being invaded with the violence and the crime. You realize that there's a problem, and the mayor has acknowledged that. You know the story. They've all acknowledged that there's a problem, but when it comes to doing anything about it, they're knee deep in mud and they don't know what to do.
Absolutely. And, you know, there was a A piece of the Baltimore Sun the other day that started by talking about the murder of homicide detective Sean Suter, a father of five, who was murdered while he was investigating one of the more than 300 homicides in Baltimore, Maryland. And this columnist for the Baltimore Sun talked about some of the emails and the letters that he had been getting. He got a letter from a guy named Steve Mason, who's a native of Baltimore, who now lives in Georgia. He said, "My heart hurts for our city. What do we do to get our city back?" And Dan Rodericks of the Sun says, you know, this guy is expressing what many people here feel privately, that since April 2015, criminals have become more brazen, their acts more wanton. And he said, Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis has to carry out his mission, fighting crime, recruiting and training new officers, restoring trust with citizens who had terrible experiences with cops before he got here. While under a Justice Department consent decree mandating sweeping reforms, he says they're not excuses, they're explanations, all stewed together into the civic tragedy that we're experiencing now. And, you know, again, I mean, you can point to, going back to April of 2015, I thought this was something interesting. I mean, like, you have people in that Wall Street Journal story who are saying, bring on the police state, Derek. You know, a couple of years ago, you had people who wanted to shut down the Baltimore Police Department. Now you've got Baltimore residents saying, we'll live under a police state if it you know, stops the killing.
There are a lot of people in Baltimore right now who remember the Freddie Gray riots and the week of peace, basically, that came after it, in large part, if not completely, because the governor sent in the National Guard. While it was eerie and weird driving through, you know, the city I lived in for 13 years and seeing Humvees and soldiers around, you also got the sense that nobody's going to be trying to sell you heroin on the corner because they understand that the police are right there.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that, while that certainly would cause a dip in crime, no doubt, they aren't prepared. The National Guard can do so much, as you know, and they deserve our respect, but policing isn't one of those things. They don't have the training. And as we saw with the murder of the police officer last week, the ACLU started grumbling that they held the police, the crime scene for 6 days. They you know, checked people coming in and out because they weren't, I don't know, maybe it's all speculation, but they didn't seem to be finding much information. They still don't know who did it, on what had happened to the officer. So they were, there's a possibility that the perpetrator was still within the block radius that they had cordoned off. And the ACLU was grumbling, this is a gross violation of this, that, and the other thing. So if you had your police state that the residents want to feel safe, you would also have the other fingers on the left-wing hand, because it's Baltimore, they're all lefties, complaining about the tactics. And if you open up the National, you shouldn't open up the National Guard to trying to do police work, something for which they're not trained, and then couple that with the threat of lawsuits should anybody do anything wrong, or simply letting the perpetrators go if they're not processed properly. All these things are important, but they can't be done by the National Guard, is what I'm saying.
Right. No, absolutely not. You need a functional, not just a functioning police department that can, you know, make those arrests, build those cases that they can then take to prosecutors, but you need an effective criminal justice system. And, you know, we heard the police commissioner, Kevin Davis, talk about the, he called it a broken juvenile justice system.
Yes.
A couple of weeks ago. But you know darn well, Derek, it's not just the juvenile justice system that's broken. One of the things that Dan Rodericks wrote in the Baltimore Sun, he quoted Rod Rosenstein, who's a deputy attorney general, formerly the U.S. attorney in Maryland. And Rodericks said, you know, when he was the U.S. attorney there in Baltimore, his office devised a strategy to warn ex-offenders on parole or probation about the serious penalties they faced if arrested again. He worked closely with Baltimore police and prosecutors to target the city's most violent repeat offenders and get convictions. And killings dropped 30% between 2006 and 2012 when you were actually getting tough on these violent criminals.
Well, it's the broken juvenile justice system that can see, when the prosecutor files, they choose, you know, do we go after them as an adult? Do we go after a 16-year-old as an adult? Or do we go after them as a juvenile? And there have been even cases of murder, Cam, where they want to charge a 16-year-old as an adult. But the 16-year-old has the right to appeal to the court to make their case that they should be tried as a juvenile. And if the court determines that, no, they should be determined to be they should be tried as a juvenile, there is no appeal. It is simply done and declared, and then you're facing a 1 or 2 or 3 year sentence for something as serious as murder. The problem isn't exclusive to the juvenile justice system, but it starts there. If you can't do anything to remove some of the irredeemable violent people, and there just are in every society, in every city, in every culture, there are just some people who are. But if you can't stop them down that slippery slope early and treat them harshly and severely in the way they should be, because by 16, 15 years old, I don't care how bad your upbringing was, you know that murder is wrong. You have pretty much set yourself on a path for crime, and you end up in the adult justice system, which, as you've illustrated many, many times, is not any better.
Absolutely. Listen, Derek, unfortunately, we are almost out of time here, but I would love to touch base with you because I know there's a lot more to talk about. We'll close with a lighter question. I've been asking this of our guests this afternoon since we're getting ready for Thanksgiving. Favorite Thanksgiving side dish for you?
Cheesy potatoes. You get those frozen hash brown cube potatoes that are cut in nice squares.
Yeah.
You put in some sour cream, some melted butter, a ton of cheese, diced onion, and a couple of spices, and a can of cream of chicken soup. Mix that all up. Obviously, you don't make it into a soup. You make it pretty casserole-y. You bake that until the cheese starts bubbling, and it gets a little crusty around the edges. That stuff is, you can just, I mean, it's basically bread, but you could stick it in between two pieces of bread and eat it as a sandwich the next day. That stuff is so good.
I love it. You gave us the recipe, too. Derek, yeah. Listen, thank you so much for coming on the program. I hope that you and yours do have a happy Thanksgiving. We'll talk to you soon.
Same to you, Cam. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody at the company.
Thank you, sir. Derek Hunter joined us from WBAL in Baltimore, Maryland. Now, that music means we got to scoot, but we will be back tomorrow with a brand new edition of Cam and Company as we head into the Thanksgiving holidays. Thank you again for joining us here today. Be safe, have fun, and we'll see you again tomorrow live, 2 p.m. Eastern on NRATV.com, midnight Eastern, iPacific, Sirius XM Patriot 125 on demand all the time, iHeartRadio and iTunes as well.